have that conversation with?
The glasses are just the glasses. Yeah, they're right out of the.
Good. The interim committee on committee on revenue will come to order. We have a long agenda this afternoon, and we're going to break it up a bit. I'll announce now that around 2 o'clock we'll be breaking in to the presentation on the business energy tax credit to hear briefly about HJR 101, and then we'll get back to the agenda as we've got it set up here. So let's open the information meeting on the business energy tax credit.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Director of the Department of Energy, and I have with me Andre Simmons, Assistant Director for our Policy Shop within the Department of Energy. Hopefully in front of you, you should have two documents that I hope to kind of walk through today. One would be the report that we issued to the Governor in late November, early December, and another should be a kind of high-level overview sheet. It's a double-sided document. What I'd like to do is just try to get everybody back up to speed from where we were last time I was here in front of the Joint Committee. We talked about the rules that the agency adopted back in November, some of the management actions that the agency has taken since June, July, and the governor's direction that he provided to the agency back in August and November around the Betsy program. And again, we've issued the report to the governor. I think the key thing as we go through the discussion today that our report was designed to target issues and recommendations that we felt comfortable with for a February session. There is going and needs to be an ongoing discussion around the program itself. Obviously, we have House Bill 2180, that passed in the 09 session, that requires a study for the program. And I expect working with you, Chair Barnhart, and others, that we will continue to discuss many issues around the Betsy program. So please keep in mind that what I walk through today is a package of initial steps, I would call them, that we are recommending to you. The report overall attempts to lay out the fact that the Betsy program is really brought up, really encompasses three distinct activity areas: conservation, renewable, and manufacturing. And it's our belief when you look at those program areas that they are definitely distinct and have their own different set of issues. And most of our recommendations focus on the renewable area because it's the renewable area that makes up about 65% of the Betsy program and a significant amount of the increase in activity in the program. And frankly, it's very dynamic in nature, and there's a level of uncertainty that's around that just because of the nature of the beast. So our recommendations really focus in that particular area. One of the other things I guess I'd like to point out, some things that we've talked about over time, that we looked at state-by-state comparisons as we were developing the report to the governor and walked away with the conclusion that was challenging to have an exact apples-to-apples comparison. Our staff identified 483 variables between various programs within the Western United States and the Betsy program. And then when you look at how those programs are implemented, how they're administered, and then the local conditions, whether it's from a regulatory standpoint or local conditions, attitudes and behaviors, it made it very difficult to try to compare exact issues. So you'll find that data in the report, but you don't see us using that in a way that's contained within our recommendations necessarily or specifically. What I'd like to do, the framework, Mr. Chair, is broken up into three areas. And what I'd like to do is kind of walk through each segment and then see if there are questions about that segment and then go on to the next segment, if that's okay.
Yes, let's go ahead and do
that. Great. All right. So the first area includes the things that we're recommending to increase program standards and program accountability. And we've thought about these issues in kind of three different groupings. General provisions that we think ought to apply just to every Betsy project, regardless of when it was finaled or pre-certified. Authority that we're asking for that would go back to a particular date and capture certain projects, and then things that would what you would be calling prospective. What's important before we get started is to kind of have a, and I know this committee is aware of it, but I just want to make sure we're all kind of at the same place. As you know, the Betsy Tax Credit Program has taken over a five-year period, and it can be extended up to 8 years. So the time in which someone can take that credit can be as long as 13 years. When we use the word pre-certification, that's essentially the date that the department has said, we're comfortable with the project, and you're okay to construct. And generally within that pre-certification, you would lay out the performance standards, the conditions, the agreements, the rates, and the amount of money that would be paid upon final. And then when the project's completed, somebody comes in and applies for final certification. We issue a final certificate, which will have a number on it, and then the applicant can take that tax credit again. It's set in statute, it's broken up into five-year increments, and then that can be extended. So it's kind of important from a base standpoint that we're all on the same page. On the accountability piece, we're recommending that we make sure that we have performance standards for all projects at the time of pre-certification. We think that's very important, and we think that's going to help you and the department make sure that we fund quality projects and that we are able to hold folks accountable to what they say they're going to do and what our expectations are. We're asking for the ability to, increased ability to suspend, condition, deny, and revoke pre-certifications or final certificates where performance standards are not have not been met. So the idea there is if we set up a situation where we've agreed to conditions through the pre-certification, you've begun to construct, and you've have failed to meet those conditions, we want to be able to go back and suspend and hold that certificate. And then we're recommending that we add clawback provisions for all the program areas. I believe in 2008, Mr. Chair, you gave us authority on manufacturing for clawback, and we are suggesting that we have that authority for the renewable area as well as conservation. That's, again, clawback is the ability to kind of come look, and when you failed to meet the standards, performance standards, pull that tax certificate from the applicant. These first elements would be looking forward to new projects after whatever date that you presumably, if you choose to take action, these would be looking forward. The next items eliminate the practice of multiple applications. This is something that in House Bill 2472 you have asked the department to adopt rules for, and we've done that. That's part of the rules that we completed on November 3rd, and we have we've taken action to make sure that we don't have the situation that some of you may be aware of and that we've seen where you have projects being broken up, a single project being broken up into multiple applications to kind of maximize the Betsy tax credit. We've addressed that administratively. We'd like you to kind of affirm that in legislation and make sure that that is clearly spelled out from a policy standpoint. We would recommend that we continue the ability to define multiple applications in administrative rule because as new technology comes in or different types of projects, we need to have the kind of flexibility to address those issues, but make sure that we have a policy statement that we're to eliminate that practice. On the number five, which is eliminate the 10% cost overrun provision, I believe that was in, it may have been in 2472A, we have taken that action through our rules as well. And what you should know is currently in the statute, under current law, it is permissive for the department to issue a 10% cost overrun between the time we do pre-certification, which is when we've given you the green light to move forward, and final, when you've completed your project. And we're asking that that discretionary authority be removed, that the amount that's pre-certified is the amount that would be granted on final. Candidly, we have found that because it's discretionary, it's become more of a norm than what we care to have, and we think that it would be just easiest just to eliminate that discretion and have it be straight up on what's pre-certified. So Those number four and five are things that we're already doing, and we would like you to, if you choose to move forward with legislation, affirm those practices so that they can carry on and make sure that the policy is clear in what we're trying to accomplish. The next item, I had an interesting discussion over on the Senate side that I believe the chair is aware of on the terms I've chosen to use, and so I've learned my lesson. But we're asking for the ability to, as it says in the document, pierce the corporate veil. I'm not suggesting changing any of the corporate structure or their positions. What we're really talking about here is our ability to follow, and I hate to use this word, but I haven't come up with a better one since yesterday, a bad actor. The situation being that if we pre-certified a project and said go forward, there may be a situation where an individual didn't fulfill their obligations under the pre-certification, and of course we need to condition revoke. There also could be a situation where it's been finaled and some partial money has been paid to an applicant, and they didn't fulfill their responsibilities. We want to be able to kind of follow that individual that found themselves in that situation if they try to reapply. We want to be aware of that. We want to be able to look past how an individual has been organized or set up their organization, not for the purposes of changing anything on the regulatory side whatsoever. I want to be very clear. But we want to be able to follow that individual so that if they failed and didn't meet the state's expectations in one project, that when they're coming back in, potentially maybe under a different name, under a different organizational structure, that we can look at that and we can kind of follow that individual and choose whether the state wants to do business with that individual in the future, or maybe we need to put additional conditions on there because of past experience and be more cautious with how we go forward. So that's what we mean. I sincerely mean that in the generic term of our ability to kind of look past the individual and the structure that they may be working in. And so under that scenario, we're suggesting that ability, if again performance standards conditions have not been met, if the project hasn't continued to operate as expected, or if any other debt or money is owed. I believe when we looked at the issue in 2472, we talked about taxes owed, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chair. And what we're suggesting is that you broaden that ability to debts owed to the state. It could be fines. It could be other things owed to state government. We believe that if you owe state government money and haven't satisfied those judgments, that we ought not be giving you additional taxpayer money for a particular project until you have remedied the problem. So that's kind of looking at the overall accountability and holding folks accountable and kind of broadening up a little bit based on experience and our recommendations to you. The next to the last item, and there's an eighth that I forgot to put on there that the chair will be very familiar with that I just want to flag for the committee. We think it's important, especially when we have the discussion about program growth measures, that we create a kind of a beginning and ending time frame that we want to encourage projects to get through the system. What you may not be aware of is in the statute currently, there are no expiration dates for pre-certifications. I have projects on our books clear back to 1985. Now, I believe folks have walked away from those projects and don't intend to final those here at some point, but they still sit on the books. We don't have the ability to go back and necessarily expire those. We're taking some administrative action. We'd like you to affirm that statutorily, but we also like to set up the practice that once we pre-certify and approve your project to go forward, I'm not talking about application. You'll hear folks being concerned that if, you know, I apply and the department sits on that application or gets behind, I shouldn't be held responsible for that time period, and I absolutely agree with that. But once we've come to an agreement between the department and the project applicant and spelled out all the terms and conditions and we've effectively agreed to both and both parties go forward, we think that there ought to be a three-year time period for you to come in and apply for final certification so that we encourage your projects to move forward. We think that's important if you choose to look at a cap because that can impact our ability to fund projects and keep things moving. And furthermore, we want to make sure that we don't create a situation where we do have some examples now where folks kind of put placeholder applications in, and we think that that's not necessarily in the state's best interest to do that. We want the projects to be ready. We want them to be viable. We want folks to be serious because we're looking at this in the context of other folks. We do have limited resources, and we want to make sure that we're spending our time and applicants' time on projects that are ready to go. So we're asking for the ability to expire those projects after 3 years. And if that was necessary, wouldn't prohibit anybody from coming back in and reapplying, kind of keeping the project going. But we think there ought to be a kind of a start and stop time. We've aligned that, Frank, just so you know, with the 3 years that we have for siting projects. You may be familiar with FSEC. That's our siting system here in Oregon. And there is a three-year time window for siting permits as well when you're dealing with renewable projects. Most of our projects are completed within that time frame. The eighth item, and then I'll pause for questions, is the data reporting. We've talked about that in my previous testimony to you. We think it's important to collect data about, you know, the energy produced on a project, the jobs created, some of the other components that you're interested in, we're interested in, to manage the program, and we want to make sure that we have the authority to ask for that information. So that would be the eighth item that we would like to have on kind of increasing program standards and program accountability. That, and I think it's captured in our report. I just forgot to pick it up in the overview. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll take a break before kind of turning the page and walk through these various issues if there are questions.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may. Firstly, on the clawback provisions, one of the things that happens with these tax credits is that they're sold. And how do we then claw back those tax credits that have been sold?
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, my understanding, I'm going to make sure that I'm not inaccurate on my statement. Andrea will correct me. But in the manufacturing side, the way the structure set up, that we actually have the ability to hold the applicant accountable to pay the state back if they haven't fulfilled their obligations, even though they've created a third-party relationship and may potentially be out that money in that relationship. Now, whether they have the ability to pay that and there's some kind of ongoing debt owed to the state or whatnot, you know, we haven't had that example. But if I'm not mistaken, that's the way the system is set up on the manufacturing side.
And sure. Of course, you just covered what my follow-up was, that, you know, in most cases, if we're going to do the clawbacks, those companies probably don't have the ability to pay back, so we're kind of stuck. But the other part,
be a leaner judgment or something like that than placed on. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. The other thing is the piercing of the corporate structure. Mm-hmm. The CCB has had this kind of problem forever with what you've termed bad actors. There are contractors who fall into that category as well, and they have been basically unable to do anything because of overriding regulations, federal probably regulations.
On bankruptcy, yeah.
Yeah, and so how is this different?
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, well, thanks for bringing that up, because as you know, from previous experiences, we've looked at these issues both from working with the Construction Contractors Board and then the regulatory side that I had at Building Codes. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that if you gave us the authority that we would be able to solve every single problem like what we see in my experience on the regulation side. However, we did pass legislation in 07, now I guess it was, to strengthen that at the Construction Contractors Board. And I think in 07 we got it as well at the Department of Consumer and Business Services for Building Codes, which is where I came from. And it was a useful tool for us to kind of look at contractors that would be moving around. So I understand other things come in on a federal overlay, bankruptcy, and you don't have the ability to kind of go back and make good. But we really think that if you can give us some general authority, and we've worked with the Legislative Council just generally on this issue and discussion, we think that this would be a useful tool for us to kind of look back and track those individuals to, again, I may not be able to claw back. I can't get blood out of a turnip. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But I can also hopefully prevent making the same mistake if it was a mistake twice. And that's what we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the same question on point six.
Okay.
How do you do that? And I'll be interested to see what Ledge Council comes up with. But maybe a bigger question, all of the some of the things that you've done by rule, you've done, all of the things that you're talking about here, you feel require legislative action, or in the case of a couple of them, you called it affirmation.
Chair Barnard, Representative Berger, that's absolutely correct. We adopted a robust set of rules. We've implemented some policies that you had provided direction through legislation, and we feel, especially on a couple of these, that we ought to get that clarified and put into the statute so that we don't get in a situation where you and stakeholders of the public have one expectation and the agency has a different one, just to cut it short.
Quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. So is that the case for all of these points, 1 through 8, or...
It would be different.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Chair Barnard, Representative Berger. It would be different for
you
each one.
You don't have 6 yet.
I do not have 6 yet. That's correct.
No, okay.
And I'm not doing 6 currently.
And you're not doing 8 currently either.
The data?
Yeah.
Some, but we would like to have that discussion about the level of data you'd like us to get, what we do with that data, and how that data can be used to enhance the program.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Interested to see the language on that.
Yeah, so are we all. And unless there are other questions on that point, I assume that what we're really talking about in this federal-state issue is the extent to which state law can be used both to establish personal liability and to establish the priority of a debt to the state as compared to debts to other people. Is there some other aspect of that, of 6, that I have missed?
Again, Chair Barnhart, we did not ask the drafters to go that far, okay, because that really gets into the corporate structure and liabilities and whatnot. We're simply wanting the ability to get the information to track individuals regardless of how they've organized themselves or who or what they call themselves. And so... this doesn't happen often, but again, as Representative Riley noted, I did come out of regulation and business regulation, and you can have a situation where Mark Long had an application in and maybe didn't fulfill the state's interest, and I show up the next day as Mark S. Long. Now, am I the same person or am I not? I want the ability to try to figure that out. I think I am. And I want to not get into any of the corporate governance or any of the other pieces about that. I just want to be able to identify myself or you and be able to say, you know what, you're the same person that did this over here. We're not so sure we want to do business with you again, or we want to be aware of that and have greater stipulations and conditions upon that pre-certification. I'm not talking about in the terms of clawback or liens or debt or any of that, and that's where I got myself into trouble yesterday with the Senate committee.
Okay.
I'm using a generic term that I shouldn't have that we used casually over at the regulatory side.
I have to say I'm disappointed in that answer because I've understood that term, and it's been a while since I practiced law, but I've understood that term to mean specifically that while an entity might engage in some practice that leads to liability, under some circumstances the owner of that entity or the manager of that entity could become liable personally for the debt. And that's what I assumed that phrase meant. But you apparently, what you're really saying there is not pierce the corporate veil, but rather allow you to keep track of the responsible management people so that you could choose whether you wanted to consider their reputations and their past actions in the consideration of an application made by a new corporation that they're involved with.
Exactly. No matter how they're organized, either
right.
past or in the future.
Right. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought Representative Bentz might come in at this point. Representative Bentz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It strikes me that you're going to have a really tough time with this this part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It would be.
I'm learning that. Slow learner, but I'm catching up.
One part where it would, I think, work, and you've hit upon it, is in separating projects from one another, where people are trying to have two projects instead of, let's say, one. Because
mm-hmm.
then you'd have a clear reason for why you're looking into why it matters that they're the same person,
right,
or the same entity, or a combination thereof.
Mm-hmm.
But to put this, quote, bad actor, end quote, description in is going to be extraordinarily difficult, and I'm not even sure that you could do it legally. So I joined Representative Berger in that, wondering how legislative counsel or AG's office would manage it. So bankruptcy issues come up, other issues come up.
Absolutely.
Very difficult to avoid getting in real trouble with it. So, good luck.
We understand. I hope I've articulated the, notwithstanding the legal challenges, the situation that we're trying to protect the public on, and that's what we're trying to do. So.
Yeah, but and of course, you're not really dealing with the liability issue. You're dealing with the
accountability,
the reputation for the capacity to carry out a new project in the future.
That's right.
Based on the capacity to carry out some previous project in the past.
That's exactly right.
Different issue, I think, than the liability question.
We chose to keep the language the same so that I could make sure I was consistent between the Senate committee and the House committee, but you rest assured I will be modifying my document here on out.
That doesn't mean I disagree with Representative Pence. I suspect he's right about the drafting problem. Yeah. All right. Other questions on this part? Please go ahead.
Perfect. So I'm turning the page to the program stability measures, which, and you'll see how I've laid this out. There are a series of kind of what I would call framework issues that we're recommending to you, and you'll have the ability to kind of plug in different components depending upon when you want to implement. So we've left the kind of decision points in another area, and we can kind of talk about that. So the first piece, and this is fairly significant, is we are recommending a program cap for the renewable activity. Again, that's the area that has the large driver, the greatest a level of complexity and influx in the program, and we think it's appropriate to establish a cap for that program and look at it from a biennial basis. What we've done, and the best way to think about this, the cap would be based on our pre-certification activity. So, again, when I pre-certify a project, when I give the project approval to move forward, I've established a number that at some point we will ultimately pay a project owner that the taxpayers are paying for. And so that pre-certification number, although that may not come out of, that may not come out of current year or even next year budget because of the 13-year component, that's a number that we would have a maximum amount for that year, so for that biennium. And so we're asking that a cap be established, that we operate within the cap, and that in establishing a cap, we're going to have the ability to prioritize projects, and that's going to be a key component. What we're suggesting is that there, and just so the committee is aware, both Chair Barnhart and Chair Burdick have asked the agency to kind of come back and identify how would you manage the cap? Would you have the money available quarterly? What would be the criteria for prioritizing? How would that system work? We understand a cap. We understand it would be based on the pre-certification level. We understand that project again would occurs at some point between 1 and 13 years. But how would you manage that? And so our initial discussions, and we haven't provided that information back. But things to consider were, you know, like infrastructure readiness, infrastructure connection. That's if there are transmission or distribution lines. Environmental concerns may be appropriate. Jobs, level of jobs that the particular project is able to deliver on. State's return on investment, so that you could get into leverage components and how much support we're providing versus from other sources. The level of power that's produced or generated. The readiness and those kinds of things. I think another important consideration that we will be bringing back to you is not only do you have to have these factors to look at, and you probably want to take whatever cap amount and phase that over the biennium so you don't run into a situation where within the first 3 or 4 months you've exceeded or up against your cap and you're essentially not providing opportunity for the rest of the biennium. We also want to have a situation to make sure that we recognize that there are large-scale job or large-scale projects, and there are medium, and there are small, and we need to make room for all of it. And we don't want to be in a situation where a couple large projects reduce the ability of smaller projects to come in at some point within that cap period. So we understand all those complexities out there. We've been discussing the issues internally, and I would expect next week we would be able to come back with some ideas for you to for you to consider in our ongoing discussions. We think that, again, a cap is necessary to provide the stability and certainty to the program. We think that it has several benefits in that it will allow us to, again, prioritize projects, fund quality projects, set performance standards, and, again, if we get our factors and our priorities correct, make sure that we're able to have the best return on investment for the money we're spending. I received quite a few questions on this. I may stop on this one if you'd like before I go into the new funding model, because those are kind of two different things, Mr. Chair, or I can continue on. If there are questions about kind of cap and how a cap would work and the concept of a cap and those
kinds of things. Can we go in the same order that we did before, Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you considered a cap on size of projects as opposed to a cap on the amount of money that you give out? It seems to me that the weight that our investment would carry with a project would be much greater with a smaller project. And that is, if a project is of a certain size, then our money is not as important.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, I'll see if I understand the question correctly. It is true that at times on certain projects the percentage of our support isn't as significant, but it's, you know, it's maybe necessary with above market considerations and other things to move that forward. And our larger projects do provide opportunities for larger jobs potentially and for job periods to last quite a while. Do I have the answer for whether we should cap certain size projects and not fund those? Not specifically. When I talk about the alternative funding model for what we're calling markets that are moving towards maturity or the ability to stand alone, we've looked at that issue, and I'll explain that here next, and that may help answer your question. But, you know, we have a cap currently, kind of per project, in that we're 50% of the $20 million, and we're suggesting moving to an alternative model for some projects to go to a percentage base. So it's somewhat in line with what you're talking about. But we were talking about a cap, or what we're recommending is an overall cap over the renewables program, and that would apply to all the various markets. I hesitate to mention them because I will undoubtedly forget someone, and then that sends a signal that I don't want to send. But, you know, we have wind, we have biomass, we have geothermal, we have solar, we have wave, we have a whole bunch of markets or types of projects out there that would fit under this kind of overall cap is what we were thinking. And again, this is in the renewables area. So any other questions, Mr. Chair?
Representative Berger.
Perhaps a comment, Mr. Chair, if you'll. What you're really talking about here is a trade-off. The certainty of a cap, you're suggesting, is worth the danger of sort of cutting off your nose to spite your face by saying, oops, this project doesn't fit in the cap, or it's too small, or it's too big, or it doesn't fit in whatever silos you come up with in this scheme. You can tell I'm not wild about this idea. And you are suggesting by this that the certainty of amount is worth that trade-off. Because that's what your stand to gain. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, absolutely. Certainty in its stability of the program and to help manage the program, absolutely. And we think that that's worthwhile. And we think that, you know, if you do nothing, I mean, whatever you do as far as looking at this program, we think it's awfully important to continue it on a level. We have developed a significant amount of infrastructure in this state over time. We have folks that are small businesses that have gotten into the energy sector. We have medium-sized. We have large. And it's my belief that if we can't provide that certainty and don't and we need to create a mechanism to provide that stability so that those things can continue on. I think it would be very detrimental to be in a situation where you had a kind of a boom and a bust situation with this program, that we manage it over time, we look out on the horizon, and we make sure that we maintain and keep moving forward on the investments that we've made to date. So for us, we think that that is a doable solution. Again, these are our recommendations for February. I think there'll be ongoing discussions about the program as a whole, but for February is to put that cap on the renewable and the high growth. A lot of unpredictability and a lot of uncertainty in that area. It's really kind of hard to manage. You know, what's the right number? How to go about it? What's the right market? And we think this is a better way to manage than where we're at now.
Follow up.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Understanding, of course, that that we're in the Betsy business because it helps Oregon, mm-hmm. and by capping you cap how much it can help. In other words, the trade-off here I'm a little uncomfortable with. I understand where you're going. Again, I will be very interested in your language and what your proposal. I'm more comfortable with a cap on projects than a cap on amount, because you will lose your ability to sort of innovate as projects come in when you say, oh, well, this is a great project, but we already let the money over here, and we're under this cap, and this isn't going to work. It's sort of like my first great-grandson being told, well, you can't go too fast here because, you know, we can only get so much information to you as a kindergartner, as a class, and so we're going to stop you because you want to go a little further. I'm real uncomfortable. I will await what you further information on this, but sure. Wanted to signal my discomfort.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to pick up on Representative Berger's point about certainty and observe that while I share her concern about the trade-off around certainty on one side, it might be reasonable to make the same observation on the other side, that there is also a lack of certainty about which projects would be going forward without support. So the general difficulty about these sorts of programs is we don't know with precision, even in retrospect, where the tipping point was on each of these. So I share your uncertainty questions.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond, I totally agree we need better reporting.
Yeah. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To continue on this line of questioning, it would seem to me that these questions point towards a fundamental complexity within how a cap gets structured. And you have cross currents that run in both directions, and finding that in any structure in a cap, the ability to communicate effectively with the market about what that is, whether or not it's going to be there in their planning and development phase, the credit, whether or not that's going to be there in the future, how do we prioritize under it, seems like a monumental task, not to mention the overall theoretical question of what does it mean to cap a program that ostensibly has benefits, and where do you set that, and is that an arbitrary limit, or how do you say certain amounts of benefits are too many or stop here. Mm-hmm. So I guess part of it seems like the communication from your department is going to be critical towards any kind of structure to help those who are in the planning and development phase understand exactly what the rules of the game are, so there isn't a distortionary effect as people start to discount based on risk, not knowing what's going to happen, and we lose the effectiveness and the bang for our buck of the credit that we're going to have out there even when we do have it. So I guess that's a very long comment, but I'd be interested in your response.
Chair Barnard, Representative Bailey, I agree at a level. I mean, I guess from the agency's perspective, we would rather have a robust set of tools in our toolbox to fund quality, high-quality projects, and have maybe more money over here set aside on an individual project basis, working with an overall cap, than limiting our ability to fund individual projects. And one of the things that has concerned me is that I fully expect new markets to pop up in this area. We're working with as they come through the system, and we accomplish our goals, and there's the ability to stand alone. We move them into an alternative area, and we kind of decline that over time, and then we bring new ones in. And I'd like to be able to retain on those new markets that kind of maximum tools in my toolbox, which are the individual program project caps. So. We think it's more advantageous overall and can set up the standards. And again, I think that's why it's important to have a quarterly amount so that you have that certainty and you don't run out, that the conditions are laid out, and that the criteria is well articulated to folks. But we think that's a better way to go than to maybe limit the individual project support and not be able to fund that next whatever it is. I'm not going to say a market because that just sends the wrong signal, but the next whatever renewable area out there at a maximum amount. So that's the thinking that went behind this. And I understand the trade-offs and I understand the complexities. We feel this is something that if you choose to take action in February to provide that stability within the program, it's something we can manage over the course of this next biennium, and I'm confident that we'll have an opportunity to revisit our successes or not next January. So,
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And notwithstanding my remarks about the difficulty of defining bad acting, I think you are both to be commended for the work you've done. I think it's absolutely great and extremely necessary. Now, having said that, what is why are you suggesting that we tie the cap to the energy market as opposed to the sure. state's ability to afford a program like this?
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Vance, we looked at, so if you establish a cap and kind of walking down that, we think that there's, obviously there's a couple ways to go about it. We could pick a number. That would be a fun exercise, and I'm not sure how we go about that. Or we could index it to something, and so we've recommended an indexing methodology. We looked at receipts, revenue receipts. We looked at indexing to business receipts, and we thought that we would tie it to energy activity. The theory being that the BETC program supports energy activity in Oregon, both on the conservation, manufacture, renewable side, and we have data within our organization about the activity that occurs within the state. What you may or may not know is on an annual basis, we collect gross operating receipts from the businesses in Oregon that either generate, supply, transmit, or distribute, I think I got that correct, energy in Oregon. It's a broad sector of all of our energy components. That's a number, and I don't remember what page it's on in here. That number we know because we get that information, and we suggested a indexing, and in our report, it was no less than 1% cap, and we thought the range ought to be 1 to 4%. And so the basic numbers are $75 million to $300 million a biennium. And tie that to the energy market because of we feel we would benefit from the natural cyclical nature. It would go up, or it go down. It's predictable. You could see it. And it has that more of a connection to what's going on out there than some of the other things we looked at. So that's a kind of a long-winded response. But that's why we chose it. And I believe the energy supplier gross operating revenue table is on page 19 of the report. And you can see over time those amounts and what a 1% index would be versus a 4% index. And that was kind of the range we recommended to the governor.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is slightly different than the question I just asked, but I'm curious about whether you draw any lessons from the almost stampede of folks to access this program. And does that tell us anything? Or I'm inclined to think that maybe it's a little too rich for what we're trying to accomplish just by measuring the line of people out at the door of your department. But maybe that's not the right lesson to draw from this or from that.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vance, I think there's a couple ways to look at that. We've looked at it as it demonstrates the need out there and the interest in the state of Oregon to for these types of projects, and we think it's a positive thing. Obviously, there are some examples of projects that may have gotten away from the department or things that, and we've talked about this in the past, things that you would question. But the fact that we've developed an infrastructure of businesses, workers, public and private entities that are interested in positioning Oregon for a clean economy, affordable energy, reliable energy, renewable energy, all the things, we think just demonstrates the need out there. The question is how do you manage that need? And how do you manage that high growth, and how do you look to the future and are able to identify, both from a market condition and otherwise, what that's going to be? And we have struggled with that. And so we struggled with, the concept of putting robust criteria and using that as a way to slow down that growth or stabilize that growth, we came up with the cap. We understand that it has pluses and minuses, and it would be interesting to administer, but we think that based on our experience of what we've seen over the last several years in the program, it's the best way to manage it, at least for the for this biennium and they're out. So hopefully I answered your question.
Representative Call?
Yeah, I'd like to follow on with Representative Bence's line of questioning there, because it's one I tried to address last time and didn't articulate very well, so I'm going to have a second round of it. And it's kind of in three parts, so if you'll bear with me. One of them is following directly on with this idea of the value of the Betsy as being the driver of its cost. And what we're trying to do with a cap is limit the supply of the Betsy in the marketplace. But if we take Representative Bence's theory that the value of it is what's driving the cost of it, then if we cut the Betsy, if we make it less valuable, then we'll simply reduce demand because there will be less need for a Betsy of lesser value than the one that we have right now. That's my first question. So I'd like to know why we're at a cap instead of simply talking about reducing the value of the Betsy. I want to be convinced that the cap is the way to reduce the cost of the state of Oregon to get the best bang for our buck out of the Betsy. The second thing I want to know is, with a cap comes more complexity in administration, and I want to be convinced that the Department of Energy is ready to take on that added responsibility. And I want to know how much it's going to cost for us, for you guys, to administer a program that's going to be markedly more complicated, considering that it's been very difficult to this point to administer the program as it currently exists.
I only had two. Okay. Chair Barnhart, Representative Call, let me see. I think I understand the line of questioning, and I guess my response would be this, and if not, we can try again. How's that sound?
You'd be the first person to misunderstand me. I misunderstood.
Again. Again, I know there's the value side and the market side related to the Betsy, but we also look at it, again, as a tool to help both on the incentive side but on the economic and job side. And our view is, I think I know where you're going. Our view, again, is to make sure that on an individual project basis, we have the ability to have the maximum tools in our toolbox, the 50%, the 20 million that you currently have. If you reduce that amount, we think that you have the potential of not encouraging the next good project or project that really needs that level of support. And they do exist, okay? Not everything we do, believe it or not, I shouldn't say this. Well, I'll just say it. We do much more than what you read about in the paper, and there are a lot more projects, high quality. I think since the programs started, there's been over 10,000 projects completed in Oregon throughout all the counties and cities on every sector related to Betsy. We've done some wonderful things around manufacturing and solar and wind and infrastructure. I don't want to go on, and biomasses and wave and geothermal. And so what has concerned me with an approach that would reduce our level to support that is, again, my ability to, when a project comes forward who really needs that extra push from the state of Oregon to really help create that infrastructure, to really bring the jobs to Oregon. We're looking at maybe going to other states. We're competing regionally. All the things that are going on, that we have all those tools in our toolbox. I hope I've answered your question. And that's really why we feel it's necessary. I understand that it's going to be difficult to manage within a cap what the cost of that is. We have not looked at. You may recall, and I took you up on it, not you personally, but the committee, the joint committee, asked if I had the staff to even administer the program that I have now within the things that we're trying to accomplish. And the answer is no, and we've put together a package that we will be talking to you about. Okay. Because we are looking at not only, regardless of what we do, at the agency level, we put in performance standards, we put in conditioning. We want to go out and monitor the projects in the field. We're not doing that. We want to walk through those things, and we think that that's important. So, anyway, did I cover? your questions?
Yeah, I mean, and let me see if I can get to where you're going to. So you think that the program is going to be administered better and see better net benefits to the state of Oregon if you're able to administer it under a cap rather than creating an across-the-board cut that would reduce demand for the Betsy in the marketplace?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Call, absolutely. But the only caveat would be, depending on the size of the cap you give me.
Well, that's above my pay grade.
So
yes, I just get to ask questions.
I mean,
well, that is the function of the meeting today. We're not making any decisions today.
That's right. So, yeah, with a cap that will allow us, based on our experience and what we see in the future and what we're aware of, be able to manage that program throughout the biennium and not create fits and starts and those kinds of things, we think we can do it. Just also for a little bit of historical knowledge, the program had a cap years ago. Talking to folks within the agency, it was administered differently than what we're recommending, in that when you reach the cap, you turn the spigot off and that was it for that year. And what I have been told by folks who have been around longer than I have is that we would reach that cap about May of a particular year. It was calendar year based. We're suggesting going biennial just to kind of line things up with agency staffing and revenue projections and all that, so that's kind of more comprehensive. But previously it was an annual cap, and they got to about May or June, turned the spigot off, and that was that. We're not suggesting that model. And I'm not sure how much, it was kind of a first in, first out type of approach. We're suggesting sending a message to the market that Oregon has a program. Yes, there's a cap, there's standards and high quality projects that meet the factors we need to consider. We'll get through the system, and we're going to manage that over the course of the biennium and have that available. And we understand the value of a large utility level, as well as mid-size, as well as those small projects that are very important to the local communities.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at your chart on page 19, and I am just curious if you have run then a projection to show, if that cap was adopted, where we currently would stand, given the forward-looking nature of the tax credit.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vance, I have not. One thing that I need to do for you, and we probably will not have available to you until the first of the year, is because of giving you a baseline of revenue projections. Because of all the things I've done at the agency in implementing rules, management actions, policies and procedures, I can kind of run down the whole list. Some of the things we talked about back in November, that is going to change the assumptions from where we either were or are, or where we're going. And that work has to be done. And I'd like to say that it's easy, but it's not. Chris can probably back me up on this. So what we first have to do is kind of figure out what's the new baseline based on what the agency has done. All the things I've done to 10% elimination of project overruns, single and multiple applications. I'm happy to say that when I reported to you back in originally in this committee, we were at a 3% denial rate. We're at 13% denial rate, just in latest data. So all those things go into developing a forecast and develop a benchmark for the program, both in the past and looking forward. Once I get all that done, I'll be able to come to you with Chris and others and kind of talk about how does that work, what does a cap look like, what have we done, where those decision points are. Okay.
One of the issues that I want to explore a little further, and today I'm not sure that today is the right day to do it, but of course the reason why we're interested in the amount of the Betsy as it goes out is that it has profound effects on the budget. Although this committee isn't responsible for the budget, all of us have to vote on the floor on what we're going to fund schools, healthcare, and public safety. And so I think that's where a big chunk of this comes from. Another chunk of it comes from the idea that we want to be efficient in the use of the taxpayers' dollars and therefore only fund the best projects, the ones that are most likely to get us the biggest bang for the buck, whatever that means. And you've described several of the ways in which we could measure that. I'm wondering if we shouldn't be considering, I mean, I know the committee is going to consider it, whether it's in the statute or not, what the implications are for the budget of any particular cap, whether we have a cap at all, mm-hmm. what the implications are for the budget, because one of the reasons, of course, for the governor's position change, it appears to me at least, to be that our ability to predict the actual amounts that we're spending without a cap has proved not to be particularly robust.
It's awfully challenging, Mr. Chair, because of the built-in nature of when it's taken and the program growth and
right.
all that. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you're exactly right.
Well, and then of course, another piece which we haven't talked about at all yet is the time lag between the time that a preliminary certificate is issued and the time that a tax credit is actually taken. At this point, if we want to understand what the obligations of the state are going to be vis-a-vis our long-term debt, like the bonds that we issue, for example, the Treasurer's Office can supply us with the amount of the payment 5 years from now or 10 years from now if we ask, based on the current indebtedness that's outstanding and what we have planned. At this point, at least, we have a very difficult time predicting what the impact on the budget is going to be in 2011-13 or 13-15 or 15-17 of the actions that we take today. So, I mean, there's a number of criteria other than the ones that you've mentioned that seem to me to be really important as we talk about how much of a commitment the state can afford to make to this. And then finally, there's two other issues that are more closely related to the program itself, and those are things such as the what it's going to take to make the long-term transition to renewables, which, after all, is the object of this exercise in the first place, is to get us out of importing expensive fossil fuels and into a situation where we manage our state economy using renewable energy instead. Of course, conservation and manufacturing all being a part of that,
sure.
but the ultimate goal being that the energy we use, we make ourselves, and we do it in a sustainable way. And as a sub-piece of that, what is the effect of a cap going to be on the and how we manage it on the development of a local manufacturing infrastructure and a local development infrastructure, which I know is an issue of concern to you.
Mm-hmm.
How do we make sure that the small, for example, solar installers who will come to my house or your house or your or the neighbor's warehouse roof and install a solar array, how does the cap affect them, especially if we face the possibility that we run out of credits in May, and they're out of business from July through January. Obviously, we want to avoid that kind of situation, and we want to figure out how to make sure that we allow for reasonable development and growth in that area. So this gets pretty complicated mm-hmm. after a while, given all the considerations that are involved. So I would simply join the question that we've been discussing about whether or not the criteria that you've proposed, which is this pricing of energy, whether that's the correct criteria or not, because I can tell you that regardless of what criteria we use, the legislature is going to have to pay attention to these other issues because it doesn't have any choice.
Mr. Chair, the cap provides stability over time and will help with your challenge of forecast and activity over time. It absolutely will. Do we need to take a break?
No. Go. Just finish the answer to this question, and then
we'll
bring up the Attorney General, as I announced earlier.
All right. Anyway, the cap will provide that stability and the ability to provide that to help you and our organization forecast future growth. Currently, we can give you that data once we're through with the baseline exercise that my department and LRO staff are going to have to work through. I absolutely am not suggesting that we create a situation where we turn the spigot off in June. I agree with you. I think that would be very detrimental. I think it would, both from a practical as well as the message we're sending to our community. And I guess, my thoughts are, and I'm probably repetitive here, is that we think with what we've been experiencing and what we see in the future, that this is a a manageable and doable set of recommendations that we can help provide that stability, maintain the program, and accomplish the goals of moving to clean energy, but also addressing energy demand through these resources. And it's not just renewable, it's conservation and manufacturing. We're recommending the cap on the renewable side because that's been the area that's been experienced the greatest growth and has been the most difficult for us to forecast in the future, frankly. Conservation, you can look at we've provided the data in the report, it kind of blips along like this, and manufacturing blips along like this. And so we think that, again, our recommendations to you, to the governor, through the governor to you, really looked at the large drivers, the large complex issues, and we put together a series of, again, accountability standards and program stability measures that we can manage through the course of the next couple of years as we learn more about the program. And like I say, the study and will come in and help us shape this for the future.
Thank you. I think for that, at that moment, we're going to take a break from the information meeting, and we'll recess that for the moment, and we'll open the public hearing on HDR 101. I want to announce that I'm opening that now so we can accommodate the Attorney General's schedule. I plan to close that as soon as he's finished and then reopen it again after 2:30. Please. Oh, yeah. Representative Parker, yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for everyone for the flexibility in the schedule. Thank you, committee. I think I will do just a very brief introduction because I will be back later on, correct?
Please, yes.
Okay, so we're here to discuss House Joint Resolution 101, which seeks to address some issues around bonding in the university system. And I think I will turn it over to our Attorney General to get your perspective on things, and we'll come back to the topic later on.
And that was Representative Chris Harker.
It was. I apologize. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. House Joint Resolution 101 is designed to clarify the bonding authority of Oregon State Universities. The challenge is very simple to state. 11F and 11G in the Constitution have never really been substantially reworked since the 1960s. And as a result, there are aspects of those two constitutional amendments which control the bonding authority of the universities, which we believe has grown out of date and needs to be clarified. The joint resolution, which has been sponsored by Representative Harker, really addresses three separate issues that have arisen with respect to the bonding authority of the universities. One is the use of bonds to fund the construction of multi-use buildings. An example might be a building with floors 2 through 8 devoted to classrooms and labs, but with the first floor a mixed-use retail establishment that has a coffee shop and a bookstore. Obviously useful from an urban planning point of view, good for university student life, produces revenue that can help support the bond. This is an existing university practice. The problem is that because of the lack of clarity in the constitutional amendments, there have actually been some projects that have had to be modified, not because that achieved the best educational outcome or the best financial outcome, but simply in order to conform as closely as possible with the language of the constitutional amendment. The second issue involves the acquisition of existing buildings. Clearly, the bonding authority can be used to construct new buildings. The question is whether they can be used to acquire new buildings. Oregon has done this, or acquire existing buildings. Oregon universities have done this for decades. Only recently, as the chair knows, in fact, there's a acquired building with his father's name on it at the University of Oregon. Only recently have we grown concerned that there might be a lack of clarity in the bond authority of the state in order to acquire buildings rather than simply build them. And finally, the third practice is the use of tuition to service the debt of bonds. Again, this is a standard practice in higher education to bond against the revenue stream of tuition as well as other forms of revenue. In all three of these areas, we believe greater clarity in the constitutional in the Constitution to authorize these practices would be very valuable. The Legislative Assembly has authorized bonds to do these exact things over the years. The problem with the lack of clarity is that there's some risk that bonds could be challenged. And even if we ultimately prevailed in a legal challenge to our bonds, the fact that there could be a legal challenge would halt the projects being funded by those bonds. Literally, everything would come to a screeching halt. And to avoid that, we think clarity in the Constitution that makes it clear precisely what the universities can do and not do would be very appropriate. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. I'd love to turn the microphone over to Cynthia Burns of the Department of Justice, who worked as one of the primary drafts persons on this resolution, to go in a little more detail for the committee. I'd be happy to answer questions, and I will defer them until after Ms. Burns' testimony.
Why don't we do that and let her talk now? Yeah.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. The Attorney General pretty much covered all the highlights, so I don't have a whole lot to add. There are, as he mentioned, several provisions here that are all interrelated because Articles 11F and 11G really are intended to work together in the Constitution. 11F is intended to provide a type of revenue self-supporting project where the general fund is not drawn upon to pay debt service, and Article 11G is its counterpart that permits for some general fund funding to pay for the project. So these changes, if we make a change in one, we need to make a change in both. So as the Attorney General mentioned, one of the changes is to purchase an existing building. This came to light in terms of a project that had some different financing methods discussed, one of which was to have someone else build the project entirely and then have a sort of takeout funding with the bonds. We looked at the Constitution and the language that was sort of permit the as-is building to be acquired just wasn't there. There are arguments that will get you there, and buildings that have had remodeling or other types of work done over the years we think are fine. In the process of that, we went back and looked at the history of those two articles when they were adopted, and it seems prudent to, in light of the history and the way higher ed has evolved in terms of its finances and practices, to update those provisions now. So that, along with that, the other change is to make clear that the definition of revenues is basically anything in Article 11F that is not a general fund appropriation. Then there's another change that will be made to 11F and 11G, well, really to 11G. Right now, a building can be financed partly with Article 11F and partly with Article 11G, but they can't be commingled. The Article 11G says you can't commingle those things in the same part of the building, which makes it really complicated in today's world of mixed-use buildings to track where the money's coming from and what it's being used for. So this would eliminate that commingling prohibition. The articles would still function, one as a self-supporting and one as a general fund appropriation type financing, but the commingling prohibition would be gone. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am just curious about why we find ourselves. What has changed? You said this in this day of commingled uses. Has there been this huge transition away from single-purpose buildings that used to be easily financed with just state dollars? And now
I think there has been. A good example are some of the projects that were approved by the Legislative Assembly in the last session. The Sustainability Center in Portland, and a life sciences building. There have been several projects that are joint ventures with Portland State. The Sustainability Center also has the City of Portland in there, some community colleges, and also some private nonprofit energy things. And as we get more and more of those projects, which provide a lot of synergy for higher ed, but they don't fit very well with 11F was originally drafted thinking of dormitories and student cafeterias.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the Constitution, let's say, is amended, then that shifts the burden of keeping these things separate to the university? Is that what happens?
Yes. Under 11F, a self-supporting determination has to be made by the higher ed board. So under this change, higher ed would look at the revenues that it has available and decide whether it can support a financing without any general fund appropriation or not. Then if it wanted to use the same financing to finance the same building, partly with 11F and partly with 11G, then it would come to the legislature, and 11G requires a match. So it would say, we have half the money for 11G. Will you put up the other half? So right now you could have a 12-story building. Six of it is self-supporting, let's say. So you could finance six floors with 11F. The top six, you need a general fund match for half of that. So three may be financed with general fund match. And then the other three would be financed through 11G bonds, which can't be self-supporting. Well, if you're using all the revenues of the university system to make the self-supporting determination for the 11F, it gets very convoluted to then what they end up doing, I think, and I'm not an expert, but they have auxiliary enterprises that I think you would create an auxiliary, which is a separate little box for this project, and track the different revenue sources that go into it. And higher ed can correct me if I'm totally off base, but it becomes increasingly complicated to separate those functions. Instead of just saying, we have a 12-story building, we're going to finance half with 11G, half with 11F, and we're done with it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right. I'm oddly enough familiar with the situation because of profit, non-profit hospitals and the activities that occur within them, so we have to keep them somewhat
right,
separate.
Right, right, yeah.
And I'm just asking the question because I can anticipate some folks that might actually read the ballot measure would be wondering if their tax dollars or state dollars are somehow being used for private enterprise, because that's what we try to avoid when we're looking at our tax deductibility activities or not our tax exempt activities in public or charitable hospitals. So I'm just looking forward to that discussion. We don't need to go into it today. I just find it interesting that how that's going to be managed if this passes.
Would this allow for non-public ownership of this kind of construction after the construction was completed?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, the language in the Constitution is being amended to say it's for projects that are for the benefit of higher education.
Okay.
So I think, you know, arguably, arguably, I think, yes.
Well, it might be something for you to continue looking into.
Yeah.
Vis-a-vis Representative Bence's observation that it is a potential issue. I also believe that there may very well be an issue that comes up that I don't want you to respond to today, but there may be an issue come up over the application of tuition funds to be obligated long-term for paying bonds. So that may be another one. I think that's a political issue rather than a legal one for this kind of measure. Other things for today? For this group, we may have some other testimony later. Thank you. We very much appreciate your coming and presenting this very interesting problem. My final observation is it's interesting how the attitudes of the legal issues change over time. When my father was working with these issues, the only question seemed to be whether they could actually raise the money to pay the bonds and interest charges, and rather than the niceties that we're getting to at this stage. And when they bought the building that actually has his name on it now, this question, to my knowledge, never came up. This was like 35 years ago, something like that.
Chair Barnhart, if I may, I think the as you know, the essence of good lawyering is trying to spot problems before they erupt, and this is really an effort. Once we identified one problem, we tried to identify all of the potential problems that could come and to bring them all to the legislature at once to try to address them at one time rather than potentially wait for something to be triggered by litigation and then have to fix it under the pressure of a lawsuit.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we appreciate your being able to get to us this afternoon.
Yes, sir. I appreciate your taking out of turn.
Great. Let's temporarily close the public hearing on HJR 101 and reopen the information meeting on the business energy tax credit, and we'll resume where we left off.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Mark Long, Director, Department of Energy. If you want to continue along the cap discussion, or would you like me to move into the alternative funding component
I think at this point you've probably got a pretty good idea of what our questions are, at least. Why don't you go ahead onto the next piece? I'm really aware of the fact that we're rapidly running out of time.
Sure, absolutely. All right, moving on down the line on the program stability measures. So what is interconnected with the program cap is our recommendation to move to an alternative funding model for what we would call either mature or markets that are able to move to standalone status. Again, what you have right now is you have, under current law, you have a 50% credit on the renewable side with a $20 million cap, as you're aware. What we're suggesting for mature markets, in this case we've recommended wind for the alternative funding model, is a 5% of the project cost. In our report, we've left the numbers vacant for here, and we believe that's the attractiveness of our framework, as you can kind of plug in implementation dates and numbers. In our report, we suggested 5% at a $200 million cap, and then the key feature is that 5% would decline by a percentage point each year until at some point there wasn't any funding for that alternative market. So the concept is we're incenting behavior over here. We have our maximum ability to do that under our existing framework. When you get to a place where we move you to the alternative model, we can establish whatever caps and criteria you would eventually, the support for that particular market would decline over time, presumably till it ran out. And my hope is that we continue to do this on an ongoing basis. This has some features that we like in that by going to a 5% model of the project cost, it does help address some of the multiple application components that we see now. And it also gets us away from potentially individuals just proposing $20 million projects as opposed to what they actually would kind of combine together. So this, in our report, we've identified wind as the market as opposed to some of the others would move to the alternative funding model. 5% of a $200 million cap as recommended in the report, again, left blank here, would still leave you at 10, but then it would decline by a percentage point each year. Candidly, we would be able to know very soon whether we've hit that sweet spot of funding based on what's happened out there. So that's the alternative funding model. I don't know if there's any questions on that. I will kind of run through these real quickly, and then we can circle back if you'd like. The other piece we're recommending is to eliminate the ability to amend prior tax returns for BETC tax credits only. I don't know if you're familiar with this dynamic. I'll touch on it quite quickly. We have folks, as you know, current tax law allows you to amend back 3 years. We have folks in this kind of five-year tax credit going back and amending, and you've basically taken three-fifths of your tax credit year one. It changes a bunch of dynamics. dynamics for the state, and we think that you ought to eliminate the ability to what we're calling look back for the Betsy tax credit program only. We are recommending that you extend the manufacturing tax credit sunset date because of the long tail of negotiations and discussions with those project owners. The most recent one that we have opened and are working on was over 5 years of discussions, and we think that there is a window of time in our country where we're going to be able to continue to attract these types of businesses, and we would like you to consider extending that to the date out in the future. We recommend in the report 2016, however, we've left that open within this framework. You can plug and play the various numbers as you see fit. We're also recommending extending the conservation program sunset date as part of the report. The next pieces are just some of the main decision points that would have to get addressed. Obviously, program cap amount would be very significant, may not be able to provide that level of information until we get through dealing with our baseline adjustment and those kinds of things. The implementation date of the program cap, we recommended starting at the biennium. The implementation of the alternative funding model, what would be the maximum credit amount? Do you concur with a $200 million cap? Do you want to go to a different number? Another component of our alternative funding model is that for the smaller projects, instead of looking at it on a megawatt basis, we looked at it on a project cost basis, and in the report suggested that projects under $100,000 still be able to receive 50% benefit as opposed to 5%. And so obviously you can move that number up and down as well. And then we have the sunset extension dates, and then the we've broken up the accountability measures into kind of three elements that what would be the dates for those. Some things we think ought to just kind of good government apply to all projects. Some things would probably begin at the beginning of the biennium, pick up some projects, and other things would be clearly things we would work on in the future. So that is the framework that we've recommended to you with the accountability components and the stability components, and again, with at least 9 different kind of decision points that you could plug into this framework. And with that, I will see if there's any additional questions.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your alternative funding plan, if we followed your recommendation on wind, do I understand that the funding would stop in 5 years?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, the model assumes that. Obviously, there would be opportunity. I mean, one of the challenging questions is, you know, what's the right level of support? How do you know? How do you compare to the other states? We've all attempted to answer those questions, haven't we? And we believe by moving to this alternative model, you can achieve greater return on investment. 5% of $200 million is pretty good investment. And by going into a declining rate, you will be able to quickly establish what's the appropriate. We'll be able to watch the market, see if we're losing projects and whatnot. But the framework says it would decline to zero. So that market would move off of Betsy support. My hope is that a new market would be mature enough to go into this area and eventually move off of Betsy support, and then we would continue to do this over and over again, because at some point I think it's reasonable that certain markets out there would be to a place, because of other factors outside of all of our control, frankly, not be subject to the Betsy support. So long-winded, but yes, the model suggests that it would decline to zero. However, I think that you would definitely be able to test and see the behavior as you go from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 to 1, et cetera.
Sure, we change stuff all the time. follow up with that. I kind of like that, because that allows you to move in new scientific evidence in other areas into this and replace the ones that are mature. And one of my, you know, thoughts all along is we're not looking at maturity now, and those mature markets really don't need our help anymore, or at least not as much. So I kind of like that.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Riley, again, this kind of packages together with the cap. Again, if you can kind of think about We would have the cap. We would create the encouragement. We would move markets into the alternative model, and it just kind of helps kind of keep this program going. That's how we're looking at it for the future. Questions?
Yes.
A comment, if I could, Mr. Chair. This, whatever opinions we might hold on various decision points within this, this has been a very, very cogent and helpful discussion, and I deeply appreciate how you've framed these decision points for us, because this has been a very difficult and confusing area, and I'm appreciative of the way you framed this very, very much.
Thank you.
Amen.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question about the 100,000. Where did that come from?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bence, it's simply looking at, and we have a table within the report, I don't recall if it's 55 or 56 projects since 2001 that we received application for in wind. It's on page 14. Thank you, Andrea. And looking at the size of the projects from a megawatt standpoint, as well as a project cost standpoint, and just providing a quick, easy dividing line. We fully expect that number would change, but we thought that, again, the beauty of the framework is that you can plug in those different components to achieve the various policy outcomes, and once we're able to provide you some of the other data around the baseline and revenue projections, you'll be able to see how that impacts your decision. And so that's kind of that was the attractiveness of the model of this framework that we've provided to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And you managed to finish on time, even with the interruption from the Attorney General and Representative Harker. So thank you. And with that, colleagues, we have a lot of work to do in the next couple of weeks to try to get this thing narrowed down to the point where we actually can look at an amendment to the bill early in this special session. My commitment has been that we're going to manage at least as much of this as we can, simply because I think we have to. And so be prepared to get your thinking caps on as these things come forward. And if you have specific ideas around that are triggered or not by this report, please get in touch with me and or, as appropriate, with Paul Warner, so that we can make certain that we're apprised of those ideas and concerns. And with that, we'll close the information hearing. Who's on the next piece? Paul doing that? You're on the first one.
Representative.
Okay. Okay. So let's do that. So Representative Reed, are you ready on 26? 3627?
Certainly can be, Mr.
All right. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3627. Do we have a sign-up sheet for that one?
It's coming. No one on it.
There's no one on it.
No one. Okay. So we'll hear from Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can be very quick. I don't know if you want to hear a summary from the experts, or let me do that.
If you can do it quickly, it might be faster. But that's up to you, up to the two of you. You figure it out.
I can start. That's no problem. It's a fairly simple concept, I think, as we go. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. Notice the number on this bill, so I appreciate the last two digits particularly. I know we've got a busy agenda, so I don't intend to be here very long. What I'm hoping to do is just a quick introduction and try to respond to any of your questions. The bill before you creates an income tax subtraction for severance pay if the person receiving severance pay chooses to use that to start an Oregon small business or invest in an Oregon small business. And I think it's another innovative way to help jumpstart the economic recovery we are hoping is underway. We certainly see the severity and significance of the current economic times in our daily lives and our interactions with constituents and people we know, but I think it's important to note that recessions can also be really important times for the beginnings of new business. Look back over history, the recession in 1954 gave us Burger King, 1958, Jim Henson started his own company, introduced us to the Muppets and the economic recession of 1978. A Harvard dropout named Bill Gates started a company that we all interact with pretty regularly. And, of course, that has a pretty direct tie to Oregon because his co-founder was Paul Allen, who has a significant place in Oregon's economic landscape. So it's, I think it's clear that it can be really fertile ground for the roots of economic expansion. The intent here is to give folks who have severance pay available to them a little bit of a boost and encouragement. The person who has the idea for the next great product or service, we'd like them to take that that plunge when it's justified. I think it's clear that small business is one of the backbones of our economy, and this is an attempt to help boost small business in Oregon. It is there's some ongoing conversation about some of the definitions that might need to be tightened in the draft that's before you, but it has a cap on the amount that an individual might use. It has the limitation that a person who elected to participate in this program would only be able to do so once. It has a sunset and a reporting requirement, so the legislature could evaluate its effectiveness and determine if it wanted to extend the program. With that, I'd be happy to try to answer any of your questions. Hopefully that's helpful, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Reed? Representative Vance.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. But I can sure see that the definitions would need some work, but it's a good idea. So, but I can sure see if I wanted to get a deduction for someone investing in my business, I might fire somebody after I handed them money. I mean, you can sure see those kind of opportunities.
I appreciate, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I appreciate your observation and hope you will help us alleviate some of those needs.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. This is the preliminary hearing that we need to have in order to get these things scheduled quickly at the beginning of the February session, which, of course, is why we're doing this today. There's no one else signed up to be heard, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3627, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3609. And I see Senator Morris is here. You're here on that one, aren't you? Yeah, please come forward and bring whoever you want to with you. And is Representative Olson going to be here today?
Mr. Chair, and colleagues, Representative Olson would be with me today, but his schedule and circumstance called him to a place that we would all like to be.
Arizona?
Pam was on vacation.
Oh.
Vacation time came at this time.
Okay.
And it was either they took advantage of that or they would forego it. So I'm delighted to appear on behalf of Representative Olson.
And we're delighted to have a member of the other body here.
Well, it's always a treat, Mr. Chair, colleagues, to join you. Thank you. For the record, Frank Morse, I represent the Senate in District 8, which is the Albany-Corvallis area. The reason that we have House Bill 3609 before us is a circumstance that none of us would ever like to have happen to a business, and that is under the Enterprise Zones, Pacific Cast Technology made an investment, had the property tax exemption, and then the worst of all possible things came, a cliff in their business where their orders disappeared. And so we met with the guests that we have today from Pacific Cast, the president, Randy Turner, and Jim Smith in the financial. And they will have testimony and can describe to you in detail the unfortunate circumstance that they had. What we would hope to do with this legislation is to set by policy, an opportunity for those businesses that have made these investments in the future and have the most unfortunate circumstances that we've had in this recession, the opportunity to make that extension so that they would continue to qualify. not to forego their taxes that would be paid regularly, but to carry forward for a period of 2 years the opportunity to still take advantage of that investment. So, Mr. Chair, colleagues, I would like to have Pacific Cast Technologies describe their circumstance and what it is that this bill can do for them.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and do that. And thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy Turner, President of Pacific Cast Technologies. We're a titanium investment casting foundry in Albany, Oregon, serving the commercial and defense aerospace market. We've been there for over 30 years, committed to be an Oregon business, have invested in our Albany site over $35 million in the last 12 years. Our recent project was about $12.5 million of factory expansion and equipment to get prepared to actually make parts when Boeing and Airbus can make more than one of their airplanes that they've sold hundreds of. So we got caught in the perfect storm. We expanded in anticipation of some very high airplane and engine build rates, which unfortunately has been postponed. So we found ourselves in a very difficult situation. We spoke to our local representatives about the concept of, is there some way to not get thrown out of the game given these unusual circumstances? We want to pay our taxes, of course. We know the state is in need of revenue, just as we are. But we thought there might be a way to extend our ability to get our employment count back up to levels that were commensurate with the tax abatement that we signed up for. And in fact, we were well on our way. The first year, we had our employment over the limit necessary. And then, as the rest of the world knows, things crashed pretty quickly. So our whole point of being here is to see if there's not some balance of keeping us in the game long enough to get back on our growth pattern, which we know is there as soon as the airlines and Boeing and Airbus in particular get back to their engine build schedules. And now I'd like to introduce Jim Smith, our controller, who can give you some of the particular numbers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Smith. I'm the controller at Pacific Cast Technologies. I guess what I can add to what Randy said was that our requirement was to achieve an additional 10% of headcount, and which would have been about 304 people, and we actually hit 340. And unfortunately, we had, because of the business conditions, we ended up losing a third of our people, and we've managed to hire a few back. But at that point, we'd already spent all the money. We added 35,000 square feet of facility on our on the back end of our building. We also bought a $5 million furnace. And these furnaces are something that you invest in, and they'll be around for 30 years. So this wasn't a short-term investment. And like what Randy was saying, we're just looking for the opportunity to stay in the game instead of just getting knocked out of a five-year exemption just because of a blip. So we will hire the people back. It's just it's a function of time and when the economy turns around. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe a comment. I think this is a good idea. We don't want to kick people out of the state, which is for an economic a downturn. I think we have to be careful, because I think that not all cases that will look like this are like this. And we have to make sure that we cover our tracks and make sure that this is not taken advantage of as I think it could be. But I think in this case, it's a reasonable thing to do.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Obviously, we'll need to look at this pretty carefully over the next couple of weeks, but we certainly appreciate Senator Marsh, you're bringing this issue to our attention. We're in an emergency right now, the whole economy, the whole world. And we certainly weren't planning on this any more than you were when we all made these mutual commitments. So let's figure out how we can manage our way through it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Michael Novak, Doris Penwell, and Hasina Squires.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I was instructed to be brief, so we're all in luck. I just wanted to say that I'm Michael Novak. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities, and the League supports House Bill 3609. We certainly appreciate Representative Olson and Senator Morse working with the League to find and address any concerns that we may have had on this issue. Senator Morse brought us down to Albany very early on in this process, introduced us to Mr. Turner and Mr. Smith. We got quite an education on exactly what they were facing and the things that they really did do to be a good partner in the community to try and preserve jobs, going so far as to furlough folks in order to not have to lay people off. It was important to the League that any legislation work to protect Oregon jobs in trouble due to the extreme economic conditions, but also that poor business practices were not rewarded. The League feels that the sideboards that are contained in this legislation work to benefit the cities and the businesses in enterprise zones, and it also preserves local control by allowing the zone sponsor to actually to make the final decision on what's best for the community. With that, I'll turn it over to my associates.
I'm Doris Penwell, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I can't tell how you hear this from here.
You're doing fine.
Is that all right? Good. I want you to take a picture. The special districts, the cities, and the counties are all in agreement on this bill.
It's not urban renewal.
You have to have been here before. You have to have been here in many sessions before. The association really supports this bill. This is a very different way of looking out at how to retain the good businesses that have been, you know, expanding in our jurisdictions. And the nice thing about it is that the business up front said, we'll pay the taxes now. We just want to have the abatement benefit later on. We're not trying to ask for anything more than we already agreed to. And it really keeps everything going in our communities, and that's what it's all about. And as Michael said to you, if you pass this bill, you would still require that the zone sponsors all of the cities involved in an enterprise zone or the county or the port. They still have to approve whatever extension is provided to these businesses. There's also some discussion about level in a rural zone or an urban zone, and you know, we can deal with that later during the session, but all in all, we believe this is a good attempt at trying to solve a very serious problem for this company and just a very few others. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association, and it is somewhat remarkable that Doris Penwell and Michael Novak and I are sitting here together, and it is a true testament to both Senator Morse and Representative Olson's bringing us all to the table well in advance of this hearing and having a discussion about the issue that their constituents faced. We have no issue with the bill. We support it. We're happy to receive the taxes for the 2 years, but they could possibly apply for the extension of time within the enterprise zone. We did designate a couple of levels between investment, as Doris indicated, between rural and urban. We felt that those numbers were good numbers, and it's unfortunate that this company is having to deal with this economic downturn, but I think we all are, and we're willing to extend the abatement period for 2 years so long as they pay the taxes during that two-year period.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony and the miraculous nature of your agreement. That's very helpful. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard? Yes, please.
Thank you.
Have a photo. Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Paul Grove with Business Oregon, and just wanted to just make a brief comment with respect to the bill. As you well know, we administered the Enterprise Zone program, and we were asked by the representative and Senator Morse early on in the process to help out and lend whatever level of technical assistance we could provide in the process. And from an administration standpoint, we think that the triggers in place are acceptable and workable, and that the sideboards that are currently in the bill and are established would help, you know, distinguish and prevent certain types of abuse that may potentially exist in the future. So we think it's a good start and a good way to help the company during this economic crisis.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill today? Of course, we will have additional time on the bills, all these bills, later. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3609. Thank you very much for coming today. And are we ready on 12?
Yes.
Okay. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3612. Okay. So we have, is Andrew Ainsworth? Yes, please come forward. And Gail? Sure. There are two signed up. We have three chairs, so we're set. And I'm assuming that Representative Buckley is otherwise engaged this afternoon.
That he is.
Yes, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Ainsworth, and I'm here on behalf of Representative Buckley. The bill before you, which I guess is 3612, arose out of an issue we started having down in Jackson County this past fall. It came to our county assessor's attention that through some errors in his office, some property owners in Jackson County weren't paying the proper taxes in past years. And so he went ahead and adjusted their property bills. And the way current law is set up, any adjustments made to property taxes are added on to the property owner's normal tax bills in the year following the tax year in which the correction was made. So this occurred, and a number of homeowners in Jackson County were affected, seeing upwards of $10,000 added on to their property bills in addition to the property tax bills, in addition to the taxes they already faced for the current tax year they were in. And, you know, in any economic climate, that'd be difficult, and this one especially, it's even more so. And it was through no fault of their own that they weren't paying the proper amount of taxes for these past years. So Senator Bates and Representative Buckley both independently began to think of ways to help address this issue and put our heads together and came up with this bill here through the help of Jackson County Tax Assessor. So House Bill 3612 would just tweak it slightly so that when back taxes are owed by property owners, it's added on in a chronological order. So 5 years ago, it would be paid in the next tax year after in which the correction is made. 4 years ago would be the year after that. And so that it wouldn't be as much of a burden at one time. And that's basically all that the bill does.
Please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Gail Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. It's nice to see all of you so refreshed. last time I saw all of you together, you weren't quite so. I'm actually not here for AOC, technically. I'm kind of filling a gap. I want to spot a couple of issues for you. And John Phillips is on vacation from the Department of Revenue, and the assessors are in their midwinter continuing education conference. So I visited with them. There's a couple things you need to know. You will need to know that this bill brings to you. First of all, there's, of course, the administrative costs for reprogramming to track these payments over time. But there's also policy issues. Under current law, after a correction is made to the tax roll, the omitted taxes are due in the next succeeding tax bill. Someone can pay trimesters and indeed can qualify for the 2 and 3% discount if they choose to pay that way. I must hasten to add, Representative Buckley knows that I'm here, and we talked about the issues, so he encouraged me to come and lay everything on the table. So I want to make that clear for the record. The intention of the owner of admitted property is not at issue. So it doesn't matter whether the owner knew or reasonably should have known that his or her property was taxable. In spite of that, in certain cases, we've seen property owners not seek a building permit and, in fact, appear intending to avoid share the tax burden with their neighbors. Nevertheless, the additional year's taxes are due without interest if they're paid in the following tax bill. In contrast, refunds are with interest. The non-paying owners have had use of that money, while their tax-paying neighbors have not. They paid taxes. In fact, in bond levies and local option levies, other taxpayers have to make up the difference for the taxes that are not being paid by the property owner whose property is omitted from the tax rolls. And corrections are limited to 5 years in spite of the omission's actual length. So one could have a structure out there for 10 or 15 years, and the state, on behalf of local districts that provide public services, would have only 5 years access to those taxes, to unpaid taxes. And again, without interest if they're paid in the next tax year. So laying those issues out for you, that'll be a matter I hope you'll discuss in the coming session. You might want to consider, if you want to move away from current law, to have, if there are any payments made after the next succeeding year, maybe have interest begin to run at that time to provide some funds so that the counties can reprogram their systems to keep track of this. So that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Geltzer.
This discussion is bringing to mind a letter that I read maybe a year ago that may have been from a property owner, I'm thinking, in Ashland.
Yeah, it's possible.
And there had been it was an error that was made, and the taxpayer actually had been paying tax, but it turned out that the tax rate was vastly higher. So it wasn't even that he should have known that he should have been paying tax and therefore wasn't. And the amount of the error was so great that it would have been absolutely impossible for him to pay that without the interest. And it was also so high that had he known the level of that tax, he would have known that he would not have been able to afford to live in that place or have that structure, and he would have sold it. So how do you find that balance between that equity that's there and putting, in this case, it seems like the impact was hundreds of thousands of dollars. Wow. The impact on that individual citizen for an error that was made in the clerk's office.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Geltzer, I would want to know more facts about that situation, because a $100,000 underpayment, I mean,
maybe it was tens of thousands. It was a lot of money. I know my eyes were.
Yeah, at some point.
It was an impossible thing for this person to do.
Well, at some points, we have individual responsibility to figure out this doesn't look right. But having said that, that's how you balance the inequities. That's your job. And you can choose to change the law on one circumstance or a small handful of circumstances that affect the entire system. Or you can say that in this case, you should have known, or you should have gone about some self-help or something, and leave the system, the balance of the equities and inequities that are in the current system in place, if that's what you choose to do.
Can I ask one more question about the origin of the bill?
Yeah.
Can you provide a little bit more insight into the background of the bill?
Yeah, sure thing. Chair Barnhart, Representative Geltzer, it really arose last fall. There was an article in the Mail Tribune discussing how many of these payments were going, or many of these tax bills were going out from the assessor's office or from the county. And, you know, there's some outrage among property owners in Jackson County who didn't realize that they were underpaying their taxes and were now slapped with these large, hefty bills. And so, I mean, that's basically where it originated from. And it was through no fault of their own. And, you know, the bill itself isn't saying that they should, you know, be exempt from paying those taxes. It's saying they should pay them, but they should be able to do so in a way that's fair to their wallets and, you know, their mental stability.
Thank you.
on that topic, could you, your office, or perhaps the assessor down there, get us more detail on what actually happened?
Sure thing.
Apparently involved a number of properties.
Mm-hmm.
That would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, I have a little bit of insight on it, although you'd be better.
Well, I think we'll wait. And
that's
and,
fine, yes.
And we'll get that information. Since we do have the luxury of having another hearing, we'll be able to do that then. Representative Call and then Representative Riley.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I just wanted to get this on the record, and hopefully we can have this information too. I mean, I'm all for personal accountability, but in Multnomah County, you can own a home that is almost identical to your neighbor's home and see a marked difference in what your tax is every year. And so to think that some homeowner who's been paying their tax that's been assessed to them year in and year out for, you know, half a decade would know to some sort of certainty that they've been misassessed and therefore liable automatically and immediately for whatever amount of money wasn't paid, I think is just an unreasonable thing for a county to assert. And I'm going to support this bill, and I think that there are going to be more examples than this that come forward.
Mr. Chair, let me haste that. I'm not representing counties at this point. I'm just spotting issues for you. And it's certainly good discussion. You should have a good discussion about this.
Thank you. And then Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, the same comment as Representative Call. I know that if I looked at my tax bill and it came in and said this is what I owe and I pay it, I see no reason that any reasonable person would question having a tax bill that looks like what they've had for a while. And you know, if it suddenly dropped, that's a whole different issue. But I think on a case-by-case basis, possibly you could look at that, but I think that is a problem in itself. So I don't think that it's reasonable to expect a normal taxpayer to know what his taxes should be on a residence if it doesn't change drastically.
Thank you. I would simply note, for whatever it might be worth, without knowing what the circumstances of this situation are, that perhaps it might make a difference if the reason for the reassessment was omitted property that the assessor couldn't reasonably have had notice of. If a building permit were not taken out when it should have been, for example, I might have a reaction very, very much like Mr. Riddell's reaction to the issue around interest and a variety of other things than if it's an error committed by somebody other than the property owner without notice. I think is the issue that Representative Call and Representative Riley are talking about, if I understood their questions correctly. Anything else for these two now? We'll expect to get additional information later. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3612? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3612 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3640. And I think we have Commissioner Kafoury. Oh, and Representative Foyle, of course. Thank you for being here.
For having me. I'll start. I'm Val Hoyle, representative of House District 14, which is West Eugene, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador, and I'd like to thank you very much for being here.
And welcome to the Committee on Revenue for your first I'm sure will be many, many, many visits.
Oh, we'll see how this goes.
Over the time.
I'd like to thank you, Chair Barnhart, and members of the Revenue Committee for the opportunity to talk to you, submit testimony on House Bill 3640, which would allow counties with populations above $340,000 to exempt manufactured homes with an assessed value of less than $15,000 from personal property tax. In these counties where you have a relatively high property value, people that are living in manufactured homes at assessed value of less than $15,000 are really struggling. And what we found in Lane County when I asked our assessor how many of these taxes are paid, she said that 94% of the taxes on these structures are not paid. So our counties, our cities, our special districts are not receiving the money. There's not a lot that you can do. Our counties do not go in. You can record a warrant, but none of our counties are throwing these people out on the street. The fact of the matter is we are not able to collect this money. And in Multnomah County, they've said that their assessor has said that if they could not spend time in these kind of collections, they could focus on collecting on taxes that will actually be paid. So this will be a net increase of income for our counties, for our cities, for our special districts. It's a very simple bill, and it's a great bill, and I really, really hope I can count on your support.
Thank you, and please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And welcome back.
Thank you. Deborah Cafori, Multnomah County Commissioner. I want to thank Representative Hoyle for bringing this bill forward. Our tax assessor, I noticed how the assessors have these bills up today, but they seem to be all on some, retreat this week. I find that very auspicious.
As I understand it, they're attending their continuing education piece, something we probably require them to do.
I know, I'm just teasing.
And it's not by happenstance that we scheduled this today either.
Right.
You'd rather have us here before you than them. We're cuter.
Yeah.
Multnomah County is a strong supporter of this bill for several reasons. First, as Representative Hoyle said, for many counties, there is very little return on investment with these accounts because the cost of billing and servicing is high compared with the actual revenue received. For example, in Multnomah County, the combined tax assessment of these manufactured homes is about $350,000, but the estimated annual cost for billing, servicing, and collecting these accounts is $118,000. In addition, we know that many of these accounts end up delinquent. Currently, in our county, there are 270 delinquent accounts with a past due balance of $74,000. What this means is that even if we've assessed the property, we aren't collecting the revenue. And second, these homeowners are, by and large, very low income and are in need of relief. The Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon has published a profile that shows that 66% of these homeowners have household incomes of less than $30,000, 41% less than $20,000, and 13% are less than $10,000 a year. In addition, the majority are older than 55, 30% of them are older than 65. Given these statistics, it isn't surprising that these individuals, many on fixed incomes, find themselves facing default and, in some circumstances, eviction. Finally, I'd like to point out that these existing statutes already provide for the cancellation of the taxes on reportable personal property, which includes floating homes, if the total assessed value is less than $12,500, but not manufactured homes. This bill will make that important change. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Berger, and then Representative Riley.
Yeah, briefly, I presume when this comes back to us, we will, Mr. Chair, have some numbers provided on how many homes we're talking about. And the only concern that I think I need to bring to the table, because this has happened in my area, is that we're not providing an incentive for irresponsible people to devalue, say, a whole park. In other words, in order to get rid of it. Do you understand? Because we've had that kind of thing happen where park owners say, oh, well, I'm not going to approve, and it begins to lose value, and then it doesn't have any tax value, and somebody, oh, well, we'll just make it go away. In the meantime, the people who are living there get moved off. And I kind of worry about that. Also, I, Representative Hoyle, it is $12,500 in the...
It is.
Yes.
But, Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, it is $12,500 in the bill, but because of... Ms. Cafori can explain it better.
When the bill comes back before you, we'll have certifiably smart people here to answer these technical questions. And although I served on the Revenue Committee, maybe you can help us. It's $12,500 in statute. However, because of indexing, the actual rate turns out to be $15,000. So it's the same. This bill will make it. these manufactured homes come in alignment with all other personal property, right, which includes floating homes.
I refer you to line 25 of the bill,
okay,
where the indexing is contained. And I don't know the numbers, but that sounds like a reasonable number, given that the indexing started July 1, 2003.
Got it. So, and thank you very much for the question. I appreciate that. But what I wanted to talk about was who would really actually be affected. Also, the League of Cities had asked us if we would be willing to have this reviewed in 2 years, just to make sure that the bill is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. And I was planning to add an amendment I think that's good governance. I think it's good policy. So when it comes back, that will be added to the bill.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, the other personal properties don't have this limitation of large counties only. And I was wondering why this has the large counties only in it.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley. What we initially wanted this bill to be was an opt-in, so that counties where this made sense, I mean, if you have a home that's valued at $15,000 in Multnomah County, it's quite different than if you have a home that's valued at $15,000 in Baker County. Mm-hmm. So these are counties that have very high property values. Instead of doing an opt-in, we were advised by legislative counsel to use a population basis so that we could have territorial uniformity in how we assess these property taxes. So that is why we picked the four counties. And also these four assessors from Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, and Lane County specifically asked us and said, we would like you to pass this law.
So that's why it says shall instead of may. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Riley just asked my question as far as where that figure came from and why the larger counties. I would just maybe add to that, change my question to a statement. I represent portions of Marion County, and I represent larger portions of Linn County. There's not a lot of difference between those two counties. I appreciate the example of Baker City, but there's not a lot of difference between Lebanon and Staten, both towns I represent. And so I would maybe like to visit the issue of the county size. A mobile home worth $15,000 or $12,500 in Linn County is still not an expensive home.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Springer, thank you very much. I spoke with Representative Clem, and he asked if we would consider adding Marion County as well. And what we wanted to do was make sure to speak with you and speak with the county assessor, speak with the League of Cities before. But I'm certainly open to adding other counties, but what we don't want to do is to mandate this tax exemption on a county that just isn't interested in participating. So I'll circle back with you afterwards. Thank you for bringing that up.
Follow up, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Yes.
And I just want to be clear, I haven't chatted with my two assessors about this, and I'm not going to assume that
right,
they would be on board, but I think that that's a conversation and a dialogue that needs to continue and be open.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Springer, the county assessors are meeting this week, which is why we would certainly have more information for you if they had been here this week. But they are going to talk with all of the assessors and specifically with the counties and ask each assessor if they're interested in participating so they can go back to their county commissioners and make a recommendation. So next week we'll be circling back, and I'll certainly follow up with you.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Thank you.
Representative Call and then Representative Berger.
Yeah, and my question might be one for the assessors, but maybe you guys can field it or maybe Day can field it. I want to make sure that I understand what we're assessing here, because I know a lot of folks who own manufactured homes, all they own is the home, and they pay rent on the land underneath. And I want to make sure that we're not creating a class of folks who actually have gotten themselves to a point where they can actually own the land and the home. I want to make sure we're not creating two classes of people and that we're helping everybody that we want to help. I'm supportive of the bill. I signed on to the bill. I just want to make sure the bill goes as far as fast as it possibly can. And maybe you guys can speak to those two different groups of people. Or not.
Chair Representative Call. I can tell you about Multnomah County. And in Multnomah County, if you own the land, it's going to be worth more than $15,000. So this is really aimed at those folks who are really the poorest of the poor homeowners. I mean, they own a structure that is valued at less than $15,000.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah, I got to point out, too, that there's issues around in Marion County has part of Salem, and Polk County has part of Salem, and Salem has a similar tax base, and so we need the assessors here.
Yeah.
I think to go through some of this, we're going to get ourselves in.
Representative Barnhart and Representative Berger, the reason that we came forward with this law that affects only counties with populations above 340,000 is that we had the request and the buy-in and the support of each of those four county assessors and county commissions. Again, talked with the League of Cities. We would not move forward with adding any other counties without having that discussion with the county assessor to see whether or not it made fiscal sense, whether it was the right thing to do. So, and we will absolutely have them here when they're not in their convention.
Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. And just one more time, it sounds to me like you're going to end up with a patchwork. Okay. And I believe that you're better off, personally, I believe you're better off saying may instead of shall and getting rid of this number.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, again, that was originally what we intended, and it was the strong recommendation from Legislative Council that in order to achieve territorial uniformity for property tax, that we needed to have it specifically apply to across the board to the same type of,
I disagree with Legislative Council quite often.
Okay. Well, for my first bill, I figured that it would be a really good idea to take their advice. They seem they're the certified smart people, so we went with it.
Thank you, Representative Riley. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 3640? I'm sure we will get more testimony later. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3640 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3646. Mazen. And I don't have the sheet.
There it is.
Oh, we do have a sheet. Okay. Representative Frederick, Michael Salaggio, Glenn Griffith. And are you here,
I'm here
on that too?
Sure.
Do you want to come up?
Okay.
Huh? Oh, okay. All right. Representative.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Barnhart.
And welcome to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Representative Benz isn't here. Representative Bailey, good to see you, sir. Thank you. And the rest of the members of the committee, thank you for inviting me. I am Lou Frederick, a state representative from District 43, North and Northeast Portland. And I am bringing to you House Bill 3646. I consider it to be about building communities and creating jobs. It addresses two areas where federal law has changed in new ways, but Oregon statutes prevent our taking advantage of the changes. This bill addresses the intersection between federal programs and state and local implementation. It's designed to make new federal programs fully available to Oregonians. It removes statutory barriers to directing financing to our local communities. House Bill 3646 is in two parts. The first part aligns Oregon statutes regarding the Oregon Facilities Authority with federal law, giving nonprofits and other private entities opportunities to finance projects and programs through tax credit bonds. It expands the types of programs that the OFA may support by allowing certain programs that are eligible under new federal programs. For example, this gives nonprofits and other private entities access to qualified energy conservation bonds. The subsidies available under the federal stimulus program were not anticipated when the statutes were written. The second part allows Oregon access to Build America bonds, capturing new federal subsidies and saving on interest costs. These savings can be used to fund more capital projects, make our infrastructure dollars go farther, and allow more projects to be funded within existing bonding capacity. The funding made accessible by these changes addresses two important goals. It creates jobs and supports training for skilled jobs, installing energy conservation materials and devices and retrofitting existing homes. And among other things, it makes building weatherization available to large numbers of people who cannot afford the cost up front. If we want to make a real dent in our energy use, we have to make conservation accessible to large numbers of people, not just those who can afford the upfront costs. These changes will not only support much-needed energy conservation and other improvements to our built environment, but it will also empower programs and the people who are already in our communities. Now, the technical details of what is changed by this bill are rightly important to us in this building, but the real impact will be felt by people in my district and in communities across the state. It will likely mean lower heating bills, trained Oregonians, and skilled jobs that help individual families and the neighbors down the street, as well as small businesses building their capacity and keeping that capacity at work, making our communities better. It goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. Any source of new jobs will help lift us all. Now, with me here is Gwen Griffith, Executive Director of the Oregon Facilities Authority, with a few words about her organization and why this bill is needed. And Michael Savaggio from the Treasurer's Office is also here to give a brief description of Build America Bonds. They can provide some of the technical details and answer your questions. But I hope that you will, in fact, support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I'm Gwen Griffith. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Facilities Authority, known to its friends as OFA. OFA is a state agency. We have one mission, and that is to help nonprofits who want to buy, build, or expand their facilities. We do that by lowering their financing costs. We lower their financing costs by issuing something called tax-exempt conduit revenue bonds. We could spend all day on that, but we won't. Think of it this
Thank
way.
You.
Think of it this way. A nonprofit can borrow funds to build a facility and get the good interest rates that a government could get. But when they do that, they're the borrower, they repay the bonds, and the state's credit is not at risk. That's a tax-exempt conduit revenue bond, in short. OFA's been around for 21 years. We've issued almost 100 different bond issues, over $1 billion in funding for nonprofits in its 21 years. We help big nonprofits and small nonprofits. Just yesterday, we closed a large bond offering for Legacy Health Services. You may know them. $123 million. At the other end of the spectrum, we were able to help the Deschutes Children's Foundation with a $700,000 bond that allowed them to finish their campus, which allows them to house lots of different nonprofits that provide services to families and children. When we lower the financing costs for a nonprofit, that money falls to their bottom line, and they can serve more Oregonians and, along the way, provide more jobs. So why is OFA here? Today, we would just like to do more. You may know that the federal stimulus package brought in a whole lot of new kinds of bonds, bonds we had never seen before. Some of our nonprofits would be able to use those bonds, but our limited statutory authority does not allow us to engage in that kind of transaction. This bill would expand our statutory authority to allow tax credit bonds as well as other kinds of bonds that are available now. And I want to make sure that we all understand we're talking about the federal subsidy that is available to nonprofits. The other thing we are seeing in our program is that nonprofits are finding very innovative ways to help in this environment. We have a couple of nonprofits that would like to issue the qualified energy conservation bond that the representative spoke of, and then create a revolving loan fund to allow others to do conservation projects and sustainability projects. This bill would allow us to engage in that kind of transaction. that's the summary. There are lots of technical questions that we can address in the future. I appreciate the opportunity to introduce you to this bill and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio with the Office of the State Treasurer. Gwen just mentioned the idea of bonds and transactions that we had never seen before, and the Build America bonds certainly fit that description. Usually states and municipalities are able to use tax-exempt bonds to finance capital costs, and underwriters are willing to accept generally lower interest rates because they don't have to pay taxes on that, on the proceeds, and that's a benefit to the state when we're trying to finance projects. Build America bonds work differently. These are taxable bonds. However, the federal government kicks back to us a 35% rebate, and that basically just comes in the form of a big, oversized novelty check. Not really. But the problem, though, is that the way our bonding statutes are set up, even if we got that check, we have no statute that allows us to actually deposit that into a particular fund. So this
that's
is
a terrible problem for the treasurer. Yeah, isn't it?
And with the size of the checks, we're running out of room. So this is just a technical cleanup to allow us to take those federal subsidies and deposit them into the debt service funds for the related agencies. Otherwise, we'll be issuing taxable bonds and not being able to take the federal rebate to help pay those back. So technical fix, good bill, should pass. I know that's not today, but eventually I hope that it does pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, we have some additional.
Ah.
If that's okay, Mike.
Please.
Not planned remarks.
Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of Debt Management at Treasurer's Office. Just a couple, I squealed when he said one thing. Is a 35% subsidy on the interest portion, not on the principal portion.
Oh,
so the check's
we
not
hoping.
As big a box. I'm afraid it's not as big.
It's not millions of dollars.
Sorry, but in general right now, the 35% subsidy was designed to spur construction. And the bill, in terms of our ability to get this, expires at the moment under federal law at the end of 2010. There is a lot of work going on to try and extend this and make this a more permanent program. Just as a backdrop, people weren't sure how it would work. $65 billion in Build America bonds were sold nationally at the state and local level last year, and $150 billion is expected to be sold. What it did was is it created a brand new market for investors who liked a taxable product that weren't in the market before. And because you get it's a higher interest rate. It's still state tax exempt, so it's an awfully great thing if you're kind of looking for income for retirement or for potentially child's education as well. So we're hoping to see more retail, but right now it's been a very large product in the life insurance industry. So there's all sorts of people coming in. Having said that, if they do extend the program federally, it probably won't be quite as generous as 35%. It may be a smaller percentage in the future because it was so generous that it's about 60 to 80 basis points cheaper to do this than to sell tax-exempt bonds. And that's after the tax-exempt market has come back, which is the good news, as you'll be hearing in the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, interest rates have returned to normal for the tax-exempt market because of the wonderful competition that was created by the Build America bonds. But still, they're so good compared to the tax-exempt market that I just can't imagine the Feds, if they do extend it, quite being that generous. But I'm hoping that this is just not a temporary fix for a temporary thing, but a permanent program. The energy tax credit bonds, not too many people have issued those yet. So if we get this legislation and we come up with a program, we'll be one of the first out of the block nationally. There's only been a few of the recovery zone bonds, which is an even deeper discount on Build America bonds. It's a 45% discount rather than 35% repayment. We're working on that with Oregon Business Development to develop a program to get some allocations back from counties who aren't using them to use ourselves at the state. And we'll just keep you all informed as the session goes on and the year goes on about new ways we're trying to tap the market. I will say that we plan, once this legislation is through, assuming you agree with our perspective, the two big Build America bonds we'll be doing this spring include ODOT bond sale. We plan to do, we normally would do like about a $300 million. We're planning to do 2 or 3 years' worth of their needs, so as much as $600 million potentially to take advantage of these great rates, because we're talking below 4%. once all said and done.
Got it.
And then we have a, right now, the OUS spring GO bond sale is looking like it's well over $200 million. So those will be the first chances we'll really be able to take advantage of these deep discounts. And I suspect towards the end of the fiscal year, excuse me, end of the calendar year, there may be a COP and a lottery bond before we're through.
So are you saying OUS could...
Well, we sell GO bonds, and so we can use it for anything that is a public purpose. So when we sell GO bonds for OUS, we will look at using Build America bonds. When we do ODOT, when we do anything that's a public purpose, we wouldn't be able to use it for energy loans if they were for the private sector, but if it's for a school, it can be used. And frankly, every school can use this. Everybody in the state could use this. We're only aware of perhaps two Build America bonds that have been sold thus far in the state. And one was for Dayton Unified School District, the first in the state. I think they did a Build America bonds. I may be wrong. Maybe it was a qualified school bond, I guarantee it. Let me go back and check. But it hasn't been used widely yet, but we plan to do it as soon as we can. I think TriMet may have done one as well.
I think TriMet.
Representative Berg.
Is this the time to call my school district that's selling bonds?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
And is this part of the stimulus bill from last?
Yes,
from February.
This was part of the larger stimulus bill, and it was just a whole toolkit of bonding ideas. Now, the problem was that we didn't really figure out what we needed until the summer, and then the legislature had gone.
We were already gone.
And we wanted
you anticipated the question I was about to ask. Yes.
We thought about using it for the COPs, but we sold some COPs this fall, and it would have saved us some money. But as it turned out, the tax exempt market, because everybody else was selling them in the taxable, we did just as good as if we had sold them taxably. But we think that for the ODOT and for the OUS and going forward, that we ought to try and if we have bonds that we know about, to try and get them out the door into this program while it still exists. And yes, I would agree that other jurisdictions should at least have their bankers or their financial advisors consider this option as they're going into the market this spring.
And Ms. Chair.
Yes, please, Representative Berger.
And since I couldn't possibly explain this to them, you'd welcome a call from them.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, the thing I'm aware of, and why I suspect you're right about the feds, if they do reauthorize this, will not go to quite such a generous program, is that the people who are going to buy these bonds are people who don't pay current taxes, like pension plans and IRAs and things like that. And so the feds have done a really nice thing because they have foregone the taxes that the bondholder would normally pay. At least they postponed them for years and years, while at the same time helping you pay part of the interest themselves immediately. So
they've been very, very successful because they're straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
You cut out all the taxpayers and middlemen. It's just a simple, you sell the bonds, and you give them the debt service schedule, and then they send you a check for the life of those bonds. And so, it's simple, it's straightforward, and it has gone over hugely. The tax credit bonds, while we will try and do them, take a lot of brain damage and a lot of legal thinking, as some of the bond attorneys here will tell you. And this is a brand new market, and we've tapped huge. Now, PERS is not as interested because we want to get the lowest interest rate possible, and of course, their job is to get the highest interest rate possible. But having said that, there are pension funds, as you said, and there's other types of buyers who, my mother being a good example, somebody who will take a 6% interest rate all the way to the bank for as long as she can get it.
Well,
and certainly, that's fine.
There's certainly no reason for a pension plan to ever buy a tax-free bond because
correct.
They want the maximum interest they can collect because they don't pay the tax anyway until later.
And this product is now starting to be sold to international buyers as well, which should even be more positive in terms of lowering the cost. This past year, we primarily have sold to, as I said, in the national market has been to life insurance companies and money managers. But internationally, sovereign credits, like states in particular, are really good credits. We sold POBs that way as well. And so as the world capital markets come back, I'm hoping that this program will be something I can talk to you about for years.
Okay. Do you think this bill is ready?
Yes, sir.
Does it need any work?
No, sir.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of.
Great. It's a great first bill to have.
Thank you. I think so, too. All right.
Thank you very much. Others who would like to be heard on House Bill 3646? Not seeing any, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3646. And now we have come all the way around, if I can find my agenda again, back to... back to House Joint Resolution 101. We have heard from several of the of those who are intending to testify. Let's see, who have we actually heard from? Did we hear from Cynthia? We did. Okay. Oh, okay. Yes. Representative Harker wants another try. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This time I'll attempt to introduce myself, as I neglected to do the last time. I think I was a bit hypoxic from my dash down from the fourth floor office to get here in time on the Attorney General's schedule. So I am Chris Harker. I represent House District 34, which is a portion of Beaverton and unincorporated Washington County. Thank you, members of the committee, for having me here and for having us here. Those of people in the room who know me will not be too surprised that I am associated with a bill that has to do with higher education. I have spoken a number of times about what I perceive to be the critical importance of education in general, higher ed in particular, in this state, and our need to do a better job of funding it. This was addressed very articulately and in a more knowledgeable and extensive manner than I am able to provide, but in November by Dave Frohnmayer, the former University of Oregon president, and in his report issued to the Oregon University System. One of the things that he says in there is that he has reminded us of the need for public reinvestment to make the dimension of difference in fulfilling the state's crucial need for public access to higher education for all Oregonians is absolutely essential. However, if we are unable to invest much more at this point in time, then we have to look for some wins that don't cost anything and perhaps even save some money. People in the room who know me will also be perhaps a bit surprised because I don't talk so much about bonds. However, when I promised to the university presidents and the chancellor's office that I would hold my bill for this February session in reserve to do what was deemed most useful, and when the chancellor came to me and said, Chris, we have a bill here. It's not sexy, but it's really important for us. I said, let's talk and let's have at it. So what I would like to do is hearken back to the description that the Attorney General provided and his accomplice from Department of Justice, and let that be expanded upon by representatives here from the Oregon University System, and we'll see if we can address whatever questions remain or that you may have come up with in the hour and a half or so since I was last here.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Parker and Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor of Finance for the Oregon University System. And I think the Attorney General and Cynthia did a good job of giving you a description of the details of this bill. And I wanted to kind of bring you up to the 1,000-foot level and talk to you about how higher ed has changed. You know, the voters of Oregon passed the constitutional amendment for Article 11F in 1950. They passed the amendment for Article 11G in 1964. And that's a number of years ago, and things have changed. We do much more research today. We do much more public service. We do much more, or get much more involved in economic development activities of the state. We have a much different student body, much more non-traditional students, and we engage in much more collaborations and partnerships with cities, other nonprofits, school districts, etc., to deliver our services. And that, in part, is why we are here today, because we have changed. We've evolved as an enterprise. We're doing things differently than we used to. And as we are seeking approval of projects, we frequently run into these issues. Well, the voters at the time these things were passed didn't contemplate these things, so thus we're here before you today. We're simply trying to obtain the least cost financing for our projects. We are not trying to expand the use of our debt in any way, shape, or form. And in fact, we have very good controls in place today that include the following. Number one, institutions have to obtain my approval, and we have debt limits for each campus that we monitor and maintain regularly, and we hold campuses accountable to a debt burden of no more than 7%. It's very akin to what the State Debt Advisory Commission does with, and I think that you know well about that. Secondly, our board has to approve these bonds, and if there are 11F bonds, they have to find that they're wholly self-liquidating and self-sustaining from the revenues of the project. Thirdly, you have to approve the project. And so there are a number of checks and balances. We, again, are not attempting to expand our use of bonds in any way, shape, or form, just would like to continue to do the things we have been doing. This is a technical fix to the Constitution. It has the support of the Attorney General, of the State Treasurer, and of our Bond Counsel, who is sitting next to me today. If you approve this referral, you will permit the university system to operate in a state-of-the-art manner at the lowest cost. Those are really the important elements of this referral. And with that, I'd like to turn to Harvey Rogers, who's bond counsel for the Oregon University System with the firm of K&L Gates.
Please.
Good afternoon. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Harvey Rogers. I'm a partner at K&L Gates. We serve as a bond counsel to the Oregon University System, and I've had the pleasure of doing that for more than a quarter of a century. I am happy to answer questions. This is a cost-saving measure for the state. If this doesn't go forward, it's not that the state can't finance everything it wants to. It's just that you have to use more costly techniques. This bill represents a collection of things that I've been railing about to the university system for years, and there's finally enough of those things all together at one time that it seems like it's worthwhile going to vote. As I say, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The constructing authority that's referred to in Section 2, who is the constructing authority generally?
That has been interpreted over the years to be the State Board of Higher Education. That language is in Article 11, Section 11 already, so we chose not to substitute something different for it.
And I assume that's by statute.
Yes, it is also by statute.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 1, the reference to in line 11 or parts thereof, that's the phrase that allows this money to be used for a building that is only partially linked to university functions.
That is trying to figure out how to answer this clearly and usefully. Article 11F1, which this has amendments to, is a companion to Article 11G, which is also being amended. It's a little hard to tell. Article 11G is the last part of this bill. Both of them authorize the state to issue general obligation bonds to finance higher education facilities, but they were adopted at slightly different times, and they use slightly different phrasings. So in drafting the amendments, what we decided to do was use uniform phrasing in both bills and combine the existing language of both provisions of the Constitution, use the existing phrasing to the extent we could, and then add the ability to acquire existing buildings, which is one of the reasons for this. So that language is an amalgam of language in Article 11F1 and 11G, and the parts thereof, I believe, is a phrase that exists in one of those two. It is intended to deal with some of the complications that arise under the existing language. The existing language, as you heard testimony from the Attorney General, requires complex allocations and accountings for multi-use structures. So or parts thereof is just intended to say you can finance a piece of something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the issue I was trying to remember or recall a couple of hours ago was a situation where the state pays for a portion of a project and the private enterprise pays for the other, and then the private enterprise fails, goes bankrupt, and leaving the state saddled with the obligation of picking up the pieces. This is something then that the constructing authority would have to deal with. Is it's not really a function of this language so much as additional risk, I guess, that we're going to be allowing the constructing authority to take.
I believe that the thrust of the amendments here is to be more inclusive about the facilities that the Oregon University system can finance. So I think it would be inaccurate to say that there is no chance under this new language that they wouldn't do the kind of situation that you are describing. However, the bill, well, I don't think the bill actively promotes that, or this language actively promotes that. It could be that some combination of the language here and some bad judgment and some bad facts could put you in that pickle, or put the state in that pickle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, is this change that's proposed in this resolution expand the risk opportunity, shall we say, that the constructing authority can expose us to?
I believe the practical answer to that is no. I believe the theoretical answer to that is yes. The reason I believe the practical answer is no is that historically it has been the legislature's process to give line item approval to each project that receives financing under 11F1 and 11G. So the Constitution, as you know, constitutes the box inside which the legislature can operate. So we may be building a little bigger box here, but we are not proposing to change any of the legislative controls on approval of projects. Is that a helpful answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it doesn't fill me with confidence that we rely upon the legislature to make sure that you must know the truth. But I think your answer is, I understand the issue.
Even members have the common experience of the legislature. Yeah. Representative Broome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who to address this question to specifically. I understand, as Representative Bentz brought out, the move to be more inclusive about the type of facility. I'm concerned, probably it's a false concern, but I'm concerned with the catch-all that begins in lines, that occurs between lines 10 and 12, specifically with the words equip and furnish when we're talking about long-term indebtedness. Some furnishings can be considered long-term. Other furnishings are certainly not long-term. And while improve certainly and construct and acquire certainly long-term, equip may or may not be, and equip can be defined very broadly. And I'm worried about putting the credit of the state out there, if you will, on this, on things that truly don't merit and no banking facility, if you will, would ever give long-term credit toward. For example, you could give long-term credit for this dais, but you wouldn't give long-term credit for this placard. So,
Chairman Barnhart, Representative Broome, I think that's a good question, and we generally look at the life of the asset and make sure that it's going to be at least as long-lived as the debt is going to be outstanding. That's not to say we do buy in, you know, let's say we're building a classroom building. We may buy the classroom furniture for that building as part of the construction project. And in many cases, I think I could show you furniture on campuses that is 60, 80 years old, should have been replaced long ago, but we simply couldn't afford to do it. And largely, those are pieces of equipment that are attached to the building and part of the building. They'd be, I think, financeable by a bank, but there are probably some exceptions to that. And like I said,
would there be a benefit to tightening up the definition a little bit? I mean, I know what the intent is. I know what we're trying to get to, and I put this out to Representative Harker as well, but just to make sure we err on the side of caution with this.
May I, Chair Barnhart, Representative Broome? This is just a lawyer's perspective. the Constitution sets the ultimate limits on what you can do, and it's setting here limits on your ultimate authority to borrow as cheaply as possible. If it is otherwise acceptable to you, from a lawyer's perspective, this is the wrong place to tighten it up. Tighten it up in the legislation. Tighten it up to the treasurer's office. I believe the treasurer's office has concern about asset life and weighted average life of financings, and it's something that we look at. And you right.
I hear it.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you. That last remark, I think, is, of course, one of the key items. The tension is between writing an inclusive enough statement to make it clear that the legislature has the authority that it's undertaken in order to satisfy the bond holders and underwriters that we do have the authority to do what we've done. I mean, I think that's your point. On the other hand, of course, we don't want to allow foolish future legislatures to do dumb things. And so that's the tension, of course, that we're facing. One of the things about a measure like this, that, of course, it has to go to a vote of the people if it passes through the legislature. Without prejudging it, I'm assuming that this is the sort of thing that would go to a general election ballot. It would be very helpful for us if, in your thinking about this measure, there were issues that occurred to you that might be controversial when it got down there. This is not the kind of measure that anybody's going to spend money on for campaign purposes, unlike the issues we're voting on this month. And therefore, a measure like this passes only if everybody looking at it thinks it's reasonable. So that's really the underlying issue that I think all the questions you're hearing from here come from. So as we proceed with this, as you look at this thing further, if you think there are areas in which there might be a controversy about it, I think it would be helpful to know. I mean, I can read the editorial today. They'll say what you just said, unless there's some problem that we don't see. Yes, Representative Harker.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the comments, and thank you for all of the questions that we've had here. I think it helps identify what these sticky points may be. We've tried our best to think about them as we've been going along. Doubtless more will come up as we have more conversations. So thanks for bringing up what we have so far, and to the continued discussion.
Thank you. Thank you. We have one last person who would like to testify, Emily McLean. All right. Well, you're off the record now because you're not near the microphone, but let me just repeat. Emily is available in case we want to ask questions about the tuition issue. Do you want to make a very brief statement and let's find out if we have questions?
Sure.
And state your name first, please.
My name is Emily McLean. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association, and the Oregon Student Association represents over 100,000 students statewide, and we work to ensure that all Oregonians have access to an affordable and accessible post-secondary education. And we've been involved in the issue and at the table in the discussions about this with OUS, with DOJ, with Representative Harker, with the Attorney General's Office, and OSA has not taken a formal stance on the issue. We just heard about it in December while we were on Christmas break. And we just do want to mention that students are supportive particularly and have no concerns about the idea of acquiring existing buildings. That is a very good economic decision. They're cheaper than building buildings in most instances, as well as changing the definition for the benefit of higher education as opposed to for the use of higher education. The concerns do come when we start discussing tuition used as a revenue, and students at this time are simply asking questions and are hoping that we can come to a compromise and make sure that we feel comfortable with the use of tuition as a revenue. And the questions that we're asking in general are, will tuition become an increasing part of the revenue to prove that the bonds are wholly self-supporting and self-liquidating? And I think that's a legitimate question because right now they make up some of the revenue. And also just, will tuition be affected in terms of the long run? Because we are talking about bonds that sometimes take 30 years to pay off. So we are in the process of these discussions, and we just wanted to make sure that the student voice is at the table because it's the tuition dollars that we pay.
Thank you. And we look forward to hearing what your conclusions are over the next couple of weeks. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Joint Resolution 101? I'm not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing. Thank you very much, Representative Harker, for staying so long this afternoon. And we'll move to our information meetings on the proposed Revenue Committee bill drafts. Representative Gelser wanted us to hear talk about LC 68 first, but I don't.
She said she would be right back.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just the first two LCs, we just give you a very quick update. LC 66 is your Betsy, and that's the one that you heard the framework on. Of course, that's being drafted. And LC 67 contains a sunset extension right now. That would include an extension for the manufacturing portion of the Betsy to 2014. We also have some definitional issues around the manufacturing Betsy, so that would also go into that LC. So that's not ready yet. So those will be the two main ones. And then LC 68, Representative Gelser's here. With the
Did you want to talk about that one?
Yes, may I?
Yes, please.
Just briefly. So LC 68 is basically a housekeeping bill that's a follow-up on... Sorry, I ran back down the hallway when I heard Moist Snuff was coming. On the Moist Snuff bill that we did last session, there were a couple of little fix-it things that needed to be done. One of them being we, in one place in the statute, talked about Moist Snuff, including chewing tobacco. In another part of the statute, it said Moist Snuff or chewing tobacco. So we needed to clarify whether Moist Snuff and chewing tobacco are in fact one and the same. So what we've done here is actually define chewing tobacco. We have clarified the definition of moist snuff, and then we have added what we talked about before, smokeless tobacco products, which include moist snuff and chewing tobacco. So it has no change in revenue fee. It's a housekeeping fix. It also provides some guidance to the Department of Revenue on how to implement the part of the law where we talked about the option of a non-participating provider to participate or pay into an escrow system. This clarifies the intent that, of course, you would never ask them to pay more than they would have paid if they bought in at that point. So we clarify it by saying it more directly in that way. Mm-hmm. And that is what it does. No revenue change, no policy change.
And it looks like you've sicked the Attorney General onto anybody who doesn't do what they're supposed to.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And there's one other... you know, whenever you have a housekeeping thing, the other things come up. There's a clarification that the Department of Revenue and the Department of Justice can communicate as required by law, but that would not constitute a felony for the person doing the communication.
That's very, I'm very pleased to hear that.
So is that employee.
Yeah, I'm sure. Questions about this one for today? Now, I'm still a little vague on the procedure. We'll be introducing these on the first day of the session, as I understand it, assuming that that's the committee's pleasure.
Yes. Mr. Chair, actually, technically you can't introduce anything formally until the first day of the session. These do not have a deadline for the drafting and for this to become in the bill form, as you saw the earlier ones. So we're still working on them. And indeed, some of them may not end up getting into bill form as we work through that process and decisions are made. But
sure.
That would be the intention. You would have them in bill form ready on that first day.
Okay. Let's work down unless there's questions about this, let's work down the list.
Okay.
Next one.
The next one is LC 69. It deals with the New Markets Tax Credit. And the New Markets Tax Credit was considered, voted out with a due pass recommendation by the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee in last session. It was referred to Ways and Means where it ended the session. And so this is, they're familiar with the concept, and it's being reintroduced with some modifications based on discussions with the revenue chairs. And Craig Campbell is here to talk about the program and kind of the basics and talk about how this draft differs from the bill that was introduced last time. I will say there are some you do have a draft in your packet, LC 69, and we are continuing to make some slight modification to that based on some additional input.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Advantage Capital Partners to talk to you about LC 69. I have with me Danielle Delgadillo, who's also with Advantage Capital Partners, mostly because we can't use the excuse of the assessors being on their continuing education retreat. So we actually have to ask her answer questions with the limit of our knowledge, which is why she's here. The New Markets Tax Credit is a federal tax credit program that grants 39% tax credit for investments in businesses in low-income tract areas. That particular program is eligible to those investors who have gone through a rather rigorous review process. They're called allocatees, and I ask your indulgence and forgiveness for using terminology like that. But after one of those entities has gone through the vetting process, they are then allocated a certain amount of the federal tax credit with which to invest. Now, they're not limited in where they can invest it. It can be anywhere in the United States, although it must be, again, in an area where the entity that they're investing in is in a low-income census tract area. The problem we've had is that most of those investments have gone to New York, California, and other attractive states for investment purposes. What this bill does is it creates a matching tax credit of 39%, which would act as a sweetener to bring those investments to the state of Oregon. We're asking for what amounts to a $78 million tax credit over a seven-year period of time to attract about $200 million in investments into the state of Oregon, with a goal primarily, though not exclusively, to be in the investment in small business to create jobs. Some of the adjustments that were made to the bill that we had during the session helped put some sidebars on the proposal. I'll go over those fairly quickly. This committee has a history of wanting to see tax credits have sunsets. The bill will have a four-year sunset. I need to throw a caveat about sunsets in this particular instance because this bill actually is a self-depleting tax credit. Once the $78 million in tax credits have been exhausted, the program is over unless the legislature chooses to re-innovate it with additional resources later on. So we need to make sure that those who are interested in investing as a result of the bill passing will need to know that that doesn't mean that they can't take advantage of the tax credit for the full part of the program. They must invest, however, within the first 4 years of the program. The bill, as it is written currently, will impose a maximum of a $5 million investment per project. Now, one thing I need to comment about that, Senate Bill 878 from last session had a $10 million limit, and there's a discussion as to whether or not it should be $5 million or $10 million. The difference being, if you go to $10 million, it will allow some property investments as well as small business investments, and that is an issue that our client really is. It's a policy issue for the legislature to decide. We only ask that you make the decision before we need to involve ourselves in amendments during session, because I understand that sort of friction is likely to be the death knell of any bill that goes through the process. Another area is that any tax credit is non-transferable, so you don't dilute the tax credit by having essentially the creation of a tax credit market around this particular tax credit. We wanted to avoid that completely. The bill does not allow any recipients of the New Markets Tax Credit, federal and state, to tack on additional tax credits from other sources. And then finally, we're pushing back the implementation or starting date for this program to the beginning of next biennium, which actually has some benefits because it allows those who are interested in investing in small businesses in Oregon plenty of time to prepare themselves so when we basically open the gates, they're ready to go and run. So that's essentially the way the tax credit works. And we're also having the benefit of a new census tract map. Unfortunately, because of the economy, there will be more low census tract areas within the state of Oregon, which actually for us in this bill actually is a good thing because it means the eligibility is more widespread. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I need to throw out. That was a pretty fast spew of information. And I'm certainly willing to answer any questions. And Daniel, do you have anything to add?
No, I think, again, for the record, my name is Danielle Delgadillo. I'm here on behalf of Advantage Capital Partners. I believe most of you have met my boss, Ryan Brennan, who's doing something just slightly more important, and that is the birth of his second child, so he could not be here. But we are available for any questions or as a resource as the process goes on. As Craig mentioned, we'd like to make sure that these changes are approved and agreed upon, if possible, before we get rolling in February so that we can not have to deal with amendments as the session goes on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one thing I should probably add is one of the reasons for this type of a bill is that right now small business is having a very difficult time finding any capital to expand, grow, or start. And this provides that kind of capital where banks are not currently able to do it. Those who wish to apply for these be eligible to receive investments must first be turned down by a traditional bank. So this is not something where they're in competition with a bank. And often when these deals come together, there is a portion that a bank provides, but it's generally where a bank has said, you want $800,000 or $1 million. We can't do that, but we can do half if you can come up with the other half, and that's where the New Markets Tax Credit comes in.
I think another great part of this program to add, too, is that the credits are delayed. It is a seven-year program. However, the credits are not rolled in until year three, so investors have 2 years to meet certain requirements, make sure that the program is working before the credits are rolled in, and then it's spread throughout the back end in the last 7 years.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those items that need to be tracked is how many jobs are created, what is the average salary of those? I should say created and retained, because one of the things, there will be an element of some of these that are construction jobs. Those tend to be short-term jobs, and we're also trying to create long-term jobs, and we want to track that creation. The average salary of those positions created, and whether or not there is health care benefits associated with the jobs that are created as a result of the bill. And so the other portion of this is the state will get the benefit of income from tax raised from the creation and extension of businesses during the first 2 years before they start paying out the tax credit in year 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. So that kind of allows you also to get a track of what kind of investment returns you as a state are getting as a result of the investments that are made under the tax credit.
Questions? Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I recall correctly, there a month or two ago, there was an announcement of a New Market Tax Credit award to several local organizations. I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about that and how it might relate to this sort of thing in the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, yes, there was an additional $1.5 billion of federal New Markets Tax Credit. There have been several extensions at the federal level in, I believe it was 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2009. And each of those have been basically another source of money that's gone out in a distribution. Now, not all of that money has been allocated, so the New Markets Tax Credit in Oregon would be eligible to take advantage of that and any subsequent offerings by the federal government as a match. I don't believe that there, I'm not sure, but I don't believe there were any New Markets Tax Credits investments within the state of Oregon, although there were entities within the state of Oregon that do New Markets Tax Credit work that were able to make investments out of the state of Oregon using New Markets Tax Credits. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps you could share with us some examples of the qualified active low-income community business. What would be normal?
I'm sorry? The business?
Yeah. Give us some examples.
Oh, we run the gamut. We have invested in small mom-and-pop bricks and mortar companies that have employed anywhere from 10 to 20 employees. We have also invested in bioscience and medical device equipment companies, which sometimes that means a smaller number of employees, but we're talking high paid, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year type salaries. We can provide some very real examples of, we use Missouri a lot as an example because we have been working throughout the past many years that the program has already
seen it gone through fruition, so you're able to see it from beginning to end. So we're happy to provide, but, I mean, we have also done tire companies where there's a company in Louisiana that is employing, I'm not sure, I think 60 employees, and what they do is they break down the tire. They basically bring it down to its real form, reproduce it, and use some bioscience materials that make it a safer and longer lasting tire. So we're just kind of all over the map.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Others today? Thank you very much. Yes, please. Mr. Esselman.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman. I'm here today on behalf of Portland Family of Funds and its affiliate, United Fund Advisors. We are a Portland-based allocatee of New Market Tax Credits, and we are the largest allocatee of New Market Tax Credits based in Oregon. We're headquartered in Portland and employ 20 professionals who administer projects utilizing the New Market Tax Credit. We fully support LC 69 as we did Senate Bill 878 in 2009 with one important exception. As Mr. Campbell testified, the maximum limit of project investment was reduced in the current LC to $5 million from $10 million. That's important to my clients because essentially New Market Tax Credits are invested in one of two ways. They're either invested directly in the business in exchange for an equity stake, or they're invested in assets related to the business, typically real estate. That's the area of emphasis that my clients pursue when making New Market Tax Credit investments. In fact, nationally, at least according to data I had from last year when I was before the Senate Revenue Committee, 63% of New Market Tax Credit allocatees do investments this way, and 84% of the job creation outcomes of the New Market Tax Credit program at that time were attributable to the real estate investments. For our purposes, nationally, we've created 11,000 jobs on more than $3.2 billion in direct, indirect, and induced economic impacts. The reason we would like to see the higher maximum cap is obviously just investing in real estate is typically a more expensive endeavor than buying an equity stake in a small business. They tend to be more complicated transactions. We have done transactions that are below $5 million, so I don't mean to suggest that the program would have no utility for our particular type of utilization of the New Market Tax Credit if we were below that threshold. But we felt the $10 million threshold in the bill that passed out of Senate Revenue last session was the right amount, and we believe the program would function quite efficiently and would give, again, it's not going to change the amount of revenue impact because we're at $78 million for this initial launch of the program if we are successful here. We would really like to see the state adopt a parallel New Market Tax Credit. It has been done in several other states where we make investments, and we think our Oregon investments have been predominantly in Portland. We'd like to get outside of Portland. We think this is a tool that could help us do that. So with that, we'd urge you to go back and perhaps take a look at that $5 million cap and look forward to supporting the bill with that change. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you. The change that you're advocating from 5 to 10, would that have the effect of investing in fewer projects?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, I don't think it is, ipso facto, if we raise that limit, we therefore invest in fewer projects. That potential exists, certainly, if you have a higher per project cap. But our view is there is a rigorous, you have a relative number of these allocatees in the first place. I think that's important for the committee to be aware of. So you have to pass through a rigorous federal process with the U.S. Treasury to get awarded your federal allocation to even be eligible to participate at the state level. So we're talking about a limited universe of allocatees. And then, of course, that also has to be paired with Oregon tax liability, and you know, if we pass this program. So in terms of utilization of the program, you know, I believe we set a target of $78 million as kind of a relative scope of what we think, you know, a first out on this, a first trial run on this program would look like. So I think it's our view that if you increase the project view, project cap a little bit higher, you won't see a more active drain on the program than if you left at $5 million. But you would exclude potentially some participants who need more leverage. The real estate transactions tend to run in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and so if you're stuck at the $5 million, you might have projects that don't proceed because we don't have that flexibility to go to 6 or 7 or 8.
Thank you. Okay. Are there, I think you said this, but I'm not certain, are there Oregon allocatees now?
Chair Barnard, we're an Oregon allocatee. So we've received direct allocation.
The description you gave earlier was for Oregon allocatee.
Chair Barnard, which description?
Well, at the very beginning, you were describing the allocatee, and
describing us. Yeah, we're an
okay.
Oregon, yes.
All right.
So we are an Oregon allocatee. Yes. Yep. Your description of us. Yep.
Thank you.
Okay. We do just to clarify for the record, Chair Barnard, we do projects. Portland Family of Funds focuses primarily on projects in Oregon. We also our affiliate. United Fund Advisors, we receive allocation and we do projects throughout the country that are led by professionals here in Oregon. And, you know, partially that's just a function of not having, you know, the tax appetite or the availability of projects here. So I think, and that was something they found very early on. They were successful in getting these allocations from the U.S. Treasury. That full appetite wasn't here, which is what caused them to set up the affiliate and do these projects nationally. So we think the state program could help spur additional activity back here, which we would like.
Of course, that's a key question when we consider a bill like this one. That I'm getting a head nod from both of you. So it would be useful if you can give us some sense as to what that means for a bill like this.
Yes.
Recognizing that it's somewhat speculative, it would still be useful.
Yes.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? We appreciate everyone's testimony today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Paul?
Mr. Chair, the next LC on your list is LC 70, and this is a redraft of an amendment that the committee looked at on the definition of working capital for purposes of the natural resources state tax credit. And I understand, Mr.
Let
Chair,
me,
you've...
Let me make one comment, and then we'll move on. This was a discussion that started out between Representative Clem and myself to try to deal with one of the issues that we've been dealing with concerning natural resources inheritance tax. And we thought we had come to a conclusion that would actually increase the flexibility of the rule around working capital beyond what is available currently in the administrative rule that is operated by the Department of Revenue. We've gotten some pushback on that, and it is very possible that this LC will not go forward. I'm not ready to say that it won't, because we may have some additional conversations taking place. But the issue around this actually just came up today, so I'll keep you informed. But if it goes off the list, that would be why. Go ahead.
The last one on your list is LC 71, which is just a generic connection to the federal tax code as of 12/31/09, that would maintain the areas you are disconnected from your legislation during the session. Right now, it doesn't look like that will be anything more than a very technical bill. Frankly, our preference would be, if it remains that way, we have an identical draft in the Senate committee to start it on the Senate side and have it come over here just from a workload standpoint.
Yeah.
But we wanted to make sure you had the flexibility, depending on what the federal government does, to start it in either chamber. So that's the purpose for that one.
And this is intended to tie us as of the beginning of this year.
Yes, as of 12/31/09. You cannot tie to a future date. So
right.
This would tie you to the most recent date passed. Of course, you can always amend that to make it 1/31, for example, of 10.
Right. So. Or, yeah, whatever. So this is really anticipating what might or might not actually happen. Any questions or comments about that?
As you recall, and members of the committee from the 08 short session, remember this did come up as a major issue because there was federal action, and you had to make a decision on it, so it is.
And we moved pretty fast, as I recall.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it looks like any other, I think we'll leave that alone for now. Those are the bills that we're ready to talk about today. So let's go ahead and move ahead. We're a few minutes early, which is great, and hear from the department. Are they here?
Yes, Deborah's
here. Oh, Deborah's here. Hear from the department on the tax amnesty program.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. As you recall, you instructed us to conduct an amnesty program. We had an application period. From October 1, that application period closed on November 19, 2009. We have, as of December 30th, processed 8,500 applications. We have also received 5,200 returns under the amnesty program. And just a little breakdown in those, these are round numbers. We had 4,300 individual income taxpayers file returns so far. We've had 325 corporate returns come in. Transit tax accounted for 500 returns, about 100 fiduciary returns, and about 10 inheritance tax returns. Again, those are as of December 30th. The deadline for filing returns is January 19th. So they still have 5 days to get returns in. And in fact, 2 days ago, we sent out letters to people who had filed applications but had not yet filed returns, reminding them of that deadline. We sent over 500 letters to businesses and over 4,700 letters to individuals. So if there's a good response there, we'll expect to see quite a number of returns coming in the next few days. Payments we've received so far amount to about $20 million. Again, those are just cash payments, so that's not going to include any installment or pay plans that we're setting up. And it obviously doesn't include the returns that we have not yet received. So of the $20 million, we have about $3.5 million from individual income taxpayers. We have about $16 million from corporate taxpayers. Around $144,000 from transit filers. Fiduciary filers accounted for about $63,000. And about $282,000 in the inheritance tax program. We are working now on setting up installment plans for taxpayers who aren't able to pay the amount in full. You might recall that the bill requires them to complete their installment plans by May 31, 2011, so they do have a good period of time to make those pay plans. So far, we have set up about $215,000 in pay plans. And Mr. Chairman, I believe that's all I have to say. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer them. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Brown.
Just a simple question. How do we gauge success with this? I mean, we have to back up. What did we think we were going to get versus the cost to do this? Is there any way to gauge that? Is that
possible? Representative Brown, we did have a projection, and that was about $17.5 million, of which up to $1 million could be used by the department for administration and promotion of it.
Gotcha.
So given that we had basically the Iowa experience and the Indiana experience is what I used for the estimates, I thought we were pretty close because I've had some other estimates where we've been a lot further off that I won't talk about. So that's about what we expect. Now, whether that's a success or not, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of...
But it's what you gauge, right?
But we were pretty close to what we anticipated. I will say, Mr. Chair, that you will get a full report from the department in the February session about kind of the results. And what we want to do is work through those and get a better understanding of the participants, and that may lead to some future discussion for legislation in the future.
I have two things. One is a comment that I suspect that the experience that you had with the amnesty may inform your audit process for other taxpayers. And then I have a question. What happens if someone filed an application during the application period and misses the return deadline?
Mr. Chairman, to your first point, yes, we do intend to use the data, the information that we receive, to enhance our compliance efforts. And we will come back in February with an update. We would also like to come back perhaps in May when you have your interim committee meeting to give you a fuller report, when we can do a little more analysis on the returns and what we're seeing there. So if a person filed an application with us, we have their identifying information, and if a return doesn't come in, I think we'll logically ask them, did they forget something and do they need to file? Or ask why they decided they didn't need to file a return or amend.
I was assuming that was the answer.
Yes. We will follow up on that. We're also looking at a survey of those who did participate in the amnesty, that they could respond anonymously to ask why they got into the situation they were in the first place. Did they not file because they missed a year and it went on and they were afraid to file, or is it that they just thought they could get away with it, and perhaps get some good data from that as well? And then analyzing the returns that come in too is going to be a big part of our follow-up to the amnesty.
So the long-term fallout from this may very well be more than just dollars in the door.
We certainly hope so.
In terms of the information that you gain that becomes beneficial in connection with administration of the entire tax system.
Yes.
Thank you. Yes, Representative
Brown. Follow-up question. The person or the entity that took advantage of this amnesty and filed their taxes and paid their taxes and are now free and clear, if you will, of the state of Oregon, how does that remain, or does it remain, on any sort of long-term record, as a public record? So somebody does a public search 5 years from now, this person paid their taxes, but part of the amnesty program, they were late and delayed, whatever the reason was. What is that person going to find when they do the public search?
Anything? Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, the laws that you have in place now, that is confidential information.
Yeah.
We do not even disclose whether or not a person has filed a return.
Okay, so once they've become current, mm-hmm. regardless of the fact that it was 2 or 10 years late, their record is expunged, if you will.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, the fact that a person did not file returns is not public information. The fact that they came in under an amnesty program and filed returns is not public information. None of that is information that the public can find.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I think, isn't it the case that the only time a tax issue becomes public information is when we file an indictment? Are there other times?
I suppose
it might be if you levied on property or something.
Mr. Chair, it's property taxes that I'm thinking of. It seems to be a public record on everything.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Property taxes are public record, aren't they? Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, I think I do need to modify my answer, because if we have a delinquent tax and file a warrant for that, and we can file a lien on property, at that point it would become public. Excuse me. But none of the information that's in a tax return or the fact that they had failed to file would be public information.
Right. Okay. Anything else? Committee, you've done a great job today. And those of you who had a morning meeting, as I did, and I could look around the room and I see several others, you've done good work. We're out a few minutes early. Thank you very much, and we will see you next in February. Is that right?
February 1st.
In February, there will be some notices filed at the end of January, in accordance with the rules that we expect the House will be adopting as we organize for the special session. And with that, unless there's something else for the good of the order, we are adjourned.
Get a lot of work done.